Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this morning session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I would like to welcome all the members here and all the members of the public. I'm going to ask everyone if you please stand, and we can do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all very much. We're going to go right into it. We have a fairly long workshop agenda. And with that, we're going to start off with Mr. Lawson talking about our garbage presentation, issuance. Oh, is it Steve?
All right, good morning, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. This morning I'm going to bring to you a brief overview of our Garvey program as we're about to embark upon our inaugural sale. As we talked about the Garveys back during session, but as you are well aware, Garveys stand for Grand Anticipation Revenue Vehicles. They are bonds that are secured by the Commonwealth's future federal highway transportation revenues, as they specifically relate to the projects for which the bonds are sold. Chapters 830 and 868 of last session, the 2011 session of the General Assembly, did authorize the issuance of $1.2 billion for the Garveys. How did we get there? It really wasn't a new authorization. What the legislation did is it took the original $1.2 billion authorization that we had for the Frayans and really converted it to be for the Garvey program. The Frayan program, as it stands, will actually be sunset as part of this program. As of this date, we have issued about $1.1 billion in Frayans over a series, three different series. The Frayans were 10-year notes, so they are actually winding down as we speak, with the final being paid off in 2016. Just as a quick picture, it is a rolling authorization. It's not a one-time $1.2 billion. It's a rolling. So at any one given time, we can have up to $1.2 billion outstanding. So if you look at, as a point of sale, we'll be looking at about about $176 million still outstanding, and we'll be looking at this sale, which we'll be doing for $350 million. So if you look at it in total, from a standpoint of available authorization, even after this sale, we'll still have nearly $700 million that is available in terms of the authorization. As I mentioned, this was approved through Chapters 830 and 868. You probably know that better as the Governor's 2011 Transportation Plan. The governor's plan did provide for the infrastructure bank, the increased size of the revenue sharing program, as well as the acceleration of the CPR bonds. In addition to that, it did provide for the authorization to sell the Garveys. As I mentioned earlier, we already had the authorization for Frayans. The Frayan authorization will sunset as this takes over. In effect, were Garveys. They were indirect Garveys. And as an indirect Garvey, they were not tied to any specific federal project. The benefits of going with the Garveys are that we will tie the project directly, the bond sale directly to a federally approved project. And by doing so, we are able to collect federal revenues annually to support the debt service and the repayment of the principal on the bonds. Now, this allows us to use the federal funds over the life of the bonds versus over the life of the construction period. As mentioned, this does give us the ability to sell Garveys, and it will allow us to reach the $1.1 billion ability of sales that we had expected to do over 3 years as part of the governor's plan. The funds will be used to support major projects that are identified in the six-year improvement program, And this first sale that we're looking to do and we're coming to you for today is to provide the public contribution related to the downtown Midtown Martin Luther King Expressway PPTA project. The debt service on the Garveys are provided from, obviously, first by the federal revenues related to the project in which it's connected to. But the project, the Ed Garvey program goes beyond that. Many states' Garvey programs are considered standalone Garveys, and they are only backed by the federal revenues. Ed Garvey program is backstopped by, first, the legally available revenues of the Transportation Trust Fund, and then by any other such funds that the General Assembly may provide. Just for points of reference, in federal fiscal year 2010, we collected about $950 million of reimbursements from FHWA. If you look at just this particular sale of Garveys that we're looking to make, we're looking at annual debt service of about $31 million. So as we look out into the forecast, the debt service on this Garvey issue only represents about 3% of our federal revenues. So it's a very small component. I know many of you have heard about all the credit rating discussions in the the press these days with the economic crisis that are around the world. I thought it was important just to kind of point out to you statements that each of the rating agencies have made as it relates to the credit ratings of the nation, the Commonwealth, and of the Garvey programs themselves. Moody's, they did affirm the AAA rating for both the U.S. and for Virginia's general obligation bonds. They did assign a negative outlook, and that was really because of the unknowings of where some of the future actions may go. And they also issued a warning in August related to Garvey's, stating beyond the short-term risk posed by the short expiration of the federal gas tax, long-term risks to the outlook of Garvey's include ongoing authorized spending levels in excess of dedicated tax revenues and the political unwillingness to raise the gas tax. So again, they have not downgraded the Garvey program, but they have expressed their concern. Standard & Poor's, as you know, did downgrade the U.S. credit rating to AA+, but they did affirm Virginia's AAA general obligation rating. And they also issued a warning related to the Garveys, as you see here.
Mr.
Yes, Mr. Pete.
Moody's. Well, first, when's the federal gas tax expire?
It's now March 1st.
Yeah, they extend it to March now.
And then, are they talking about Virginia's refusal to raise the gas tax or the federal?
This is federal. These statements are from a federal perspective.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yes. Follow-up question. So in comparing to Franz, would we expect then our pricing to not be as favorable on Garvey's than it would be on Franz, since they've issued these negative outlooks to Garvey's, since they're tied to a specific project?
No. Based on what we are seeing, because of the backstopping that we have of the trust fund, and you have this in effect the same credit as you would have had on the Franz. So we don't see this as being any detriment to our outlook in the market. Fitch also made a statement, as you see here. They did affirm the AAA rating for both the U.S. and Virginia, and assigned a stable outlook. You may have heard here, though, that they did put a revised the outlook on standalone Garveys to negative. And the importance there is that is the standalone Garveys, which every Garvey program is backstopped.
Gotcha.
Just wanted to point out three Garvey transactions that have been taking place this year. Idaho made a sale in July, District of Columbia had a sale in February, and Arizona made a sale in January. All three sales were received well by the market, and we don't anticipate anything less when we go to market ourselves.
Wow, pretty good price.
Air offering, what we're looking to do is to put forth a through a negotiated sale, an issue of approximately $350 million. We would expect, are expecting to receive a AA rated rating on this issuance, similar to what we had on the CPR bonds and the FRANs in the past. As mentioned, we do have the backstopping of these while they are first paid for by the project-specific federal reimbursements, but then they are the backstops of the state funds. We are looking to sell these as 15-year maturity bonds. As I mentioned earlier, the FRANs were 10-year notes. We have the ability in the authorization to go to 20 years. We've chosen to go with a 15-year, which is what we talked about last year during session. In terms of calendar, we are, it's changed a little bit from the slide you see here as we were working through this last minute plan, but the actual sale is now probably being slipped probably until February. As we look now to kind of finalize the MOA with Federal Highway, which will probably take place in the month of November, we will probably do rating agency meetings the first of the year following Treasury Board approval in December. So we're looking at a little bit of delay here. We're just sliding out the intended sale a little bit just because of the timing of the needed funds for the closing of the PPTA project. I think all of you have copies of the bond documents in your materials. I think as an action item this afternoon, I'll be seeking your approval of this Garvey sale, and we will proceed forward to move with to Treasury Board and to complete and issue the sale.
Any questions, Mr. Lawson? Okay. Next, the financial report for VDOT.
All right. This morning I want to give you an update on spending. This is the first actual finance report I've given you this year, so I'll be talking about activity through September. And I'll also be talking about some of the additions I've made to this report to kind of address some of the comments that some of you have raised. I've had some discussions with Mr. Miller and Mr. Lane concerning some of this additional information, and I hope you will find it to be beneficial. Through September, the CTF revenues are 2% behind where they were in September of 2010. The official growth rate...
0.2.
Okay. Yes, I'm sorry if I misspoke. But 0.2% behind where they were last September. The official growth rate for the year is 2.6% growth. There is a year-over-year, September-over-September change of a reduction of 4.2%. Not to make this seem more bleak than it is, the large component of this difference we're seeing is related to one source, the insurance premium revenues. If we exclude that insurance premium revenue, the difference is only, it's a 2.1% growth versus a 2.6% growth. The reason I point that out is air insurance premium revenues are the amount that we receive are determined based on last fiscal year's actual collections. And then transportation receives the first dollars as they are collected by the Commonwealth until that amount is reached. So while we are slower getting there, we will still obtain the projected forecasted amount for this fiscal year. If you look at motor vehicle sales and use tax collections, we're still on a rise year over year. However, there was a decrease September over September of just over 3%. We still are showing a year-to-date growth of almost 6%. Motor fuel tax collections are declining. We're down 3.2% this year. Again, we had 4.1% decrease September compared to September. and this is obviously falling short of the forecasted growth of 2.7%. Estate sales and use tax collections are up over 7% this year. A large part of that is related to the change that was made to the accelerated sales tax this last session, where they kind of partially repealed that program. There was an increase in September of over 6%, and which is currently exceeding the forecast of 5%. This chart just illustrates each of the main categories of revenues of the CTF and the comparison to the estimate, and you see the fiscal 12 amount and the fiscal 11 amount as a comparison. In terms of federal revenue, we've collected $13.5 million more than we had collected as of this point in time in fiscal year 2011. The increases here are really being driven by the maintenance activity in the maintenance program and the ARRA projects. Okay. Turning to spending, through the first quarter of the year, we spent just over $1 billion, $144 million more than had been spent through the first quarter of 2010. Approximately 47% of the spending of that $1 billion relates to VDOT's maintenance. If you include maintenance payments to localities, 56% of all spending is related to maintenance. If you look to construction, about 37% of the spending is related to that program. This graphically gives you the comparison of spending year over year. The top bar, the blue bar, represents fiscal year 12 expenditures. And the orange bar, the bottom bar, represents fiscal year 10 expenditures. You can see where construction is slightly behind where it was a year ago, and maintenance is considerably further ahead than where we were a year ago. This chart's new. Many of you were questioned whether or not, or how we knew how well we were doing towards what we thought we were going to spend. Discussions have been that our budget is based on funds available to us, not necessarily an actual planned spending. So what I've shown for you here is a little insight into that planned spending. The first column, the programs are the major programs that we operate under that you've seen in the one-page report and the other items I've shown you. The current operating budget, again, is the amount available to us. The forecasted annual spending is the amount that we believe today we will spend between now and we'll have spent by the end of the fiscal year. To make it a little tighter, we're now showing you the forecasted spending to date, which is how much we thought we would have spent through September, and then with a comparison to the fiscal year 12 expenditures to date. So that's what we spent through September.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Lawson, the forecasted annual spending, is that going to be a static number for the whole year?
What we will do is I'm going to hold that number constant, and then we will update that number during the course of the year, but I will show you both numbers. I will show you the number that...
Because that's what we're trying, obviously. If you start changing that number, then...
Right. And the reason
without showing both numbers, then you're not going to have sort of the original plan.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
So just to walk you through, I'll walk you through the highway system maintenance road just for comparison purposes and explanation. You can see there that we have an operating budget of $1.898 billion. We plan to spend $1.792 billion. So that difference of about $100 million is the balance we would anticipate at year end. The forecasted spending through the first quarter was $595 million, of which we spent $496 million. So we actually fell short of our forecasted spending in the first quarter by about $99 million. And you may ask why.
Why?
I knew inquiring minds want to know. We believe that the biggest issue we see here is, one, just the timing of the work of the contractors. Again, the contractors have the full term of the period to do this work. So there may have been a little, slowness in that activity in the middle of the summer, because they were pretty heavy toward the end of last fiscal year. And we also had the weather issues related to in August and September. There were some significant periods of rain when paving couldn't be done. That would have certainly, impacted the ability for paving or those types of activities to happen. So we are, at this point, of the opinion that $100 million shortage will kind of remain constant throughout the year to get us, so that we'll end the year still at roughly the same place.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Lawson? I should have asked you this before today, but I didn't. I apologize. $5.2 billion that we're showing as the operating budget. As I sort of look at the forecast of 3.9, that's made up of basically two components. One is the current operating budget, and the other piece is previous amounts of money, previous budgets that we've not yet spent, that are going to be spent this year. And so we have a gap, if you will, of at least $1.3 billion. More than that, of current operating budget that we won't get spent this year, because we know we're spending some money from that operating budget this year, but we're also spending money from previous years. So the delta is at least 1.3. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
More than 1.3.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And in your presentation, I think you do this later, but in your presentation, we're always chasing this goal to make sure we spend our money as quickly as possible, but efficiently and properly, so that we get the work done. And so if you show these in concert or together, showing sort of what the gap is, what the outstanding money is, the previous money that's sitting there, because our goal should be to whittle that down as quickly as possible, given being effective and efficient with it. And I think you have that in your package somewhere, but if you don't, I'm looking for.
Right, because that $1.898 billion for maintenance, that includes the carry forward from last year.
And we're going to spend
$1.792. So we're actually spending, all of this year's money plus all but $100 million of what was carried over from last year.
Right, but and that happens other than perhaps debt service. That's also going to be in construction as well. Is that
right.
Correct?
Right. Yeah, and part of the debt gap you see here is in the construction program, especially in the bond financed component.
Right.
Because
right.
we're selling the Garveys now, which we're not sure exactly when the spending of that will start to take place. And we don't plan to sell the CPR. We have a CPR sale planned in May, which will have very little impact on spending this fiscal year.
So I'm just trying to keep myself focused on sort of the balance sheet component, which is the money's allocated but not spent, and how are we doing with that? And so that piece is, along with this, will get me where I need to go.
Okay.
Thank you.
More specifically focusing on maintenance, as I mentioned earlier, we're significantly further ahead of where we were a year ago, 55% ahead. We've spent $182 million in September alone for a year-to-date total of $496 million compared to about $319 the year before. And as I mentioned, while we are below spend plan through September, we do feel that our spending through the rest of the year will put us in a position to where we'll be about $100 million, about have an unspent balance of about $100 million at the end of the fiscal year. In construction, we spent $385 million through September. $60 million of that related to ARRA projects, which was an increase over last year. The other construction programs are actually down. Primary has an increase. The other programs are down. The biggest decreases you see are in interstate and in the statewide. Well, in the interstate, it's the big ones. The reasoning for there is that we had some work related to the hot lanes and to some wrap-up work on Woodrow Wilson that were ongoing at the end of last fiscal year that we were incurring in expenditures. Those projects have now fallen off, and we have many new projects obviously getting ramped up, but those expenditures have not started to be seen at this point. This is your familiar graph showing the contract work underway for the construction and maintenance contracts. You can see here where over the last 12 months, the comparison of October 1 to October 1, the significant change that's taken place, especially in the maintenance side, with the large ramp up in contracts that are on the street, and then and you can see as the season is working underway that the balances of those contracts are being brought down. From a cash picture, we are $238 million less cash on hand than we were at the beginning of the fiscal year. HMO is down about $170 million. The TPOF shows an increase. That increase is due to the new capitalization that was provided to the program, as well as some reimbursement of bond proceeds that were supporting that program. The construction or trust fund in whole is down about $55 million. You see the net impact there between the big decrease in the construction, yet the increase in the infrastructure bank as we provided the $250 million funding to that program. And then you see it on the very bottom, we've spent about $80 million of the CPR bonds. To summarize, the state revenues are tracking slightly below forecast. From a spending perspective, for the most part, most of the programs are spending very, very close to forecast. Maintenance is off to a little bit of a slow start, but we do believe that spending will improve as we carry out the rest of the year, and we'll end the year with a maintenance unspent balance of about $100 million.
Any questions, Mr. Lawson?
I have one.
Yes, Mr. Sir.
With the continued uncertainty of federal funding, and I guess nobody knows now where we are on that, how do we factor that into the future? What are we projecting for federal money coming into the Commonwealth?
We are still, and lack of any better guidance, we are still forecasting the federal outlook based on our current federal fiscal year funding levels. We use a growth factor based on Virginia's estimated fuel tax consumption growth. So it's a very minimal growth that's anticipated in our federal revenue outlook. I mean, it's still, what we're looking at today is still based on the budget and the program that you approved in June.
Is there any contingency planning on what if we really get reduced? Then what happens? Are we looking at that? Or?
One thing about the construction programs, projects take time to develop and to mature, and we feel that we have plenty opportunity to address a change in pace, in other words, in the federal outlook. Once we were to know what that change is, versus trying to take some reactive measure today that could put us back where we were before with those federal reserve amounts just sitting and not putting projects to work.
Do we have any idea when this will be, when we'll have any clear roadmap from the federal government on funding? Or is that asking too crazy of a question?
Too much.
My crystal ball isn't that good. we're on course now for a March continuation, and I think most will say that it will get continued again beyond that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Blair.
I looked on the agenda. This is probably a good place to ask it. With the revenues not tracking the forecast, I'm sure the Department of Transportation has been asked to take a look at contingency plans if we have to reduce our budget. So my question is, you know, what do we do if we have to do that? I'm not talking about the six-year plan, but of course, obviously, just your operating budget, Mr. World. I mean, I guess you're looking at, what type of things are you looking at we have to do?
In terms of reducing the operating budget, if we did have such a revenue reduction, the majority of the change would come in the adjusting the six-year program.
Okay.
All right. And so that would be the majority of the change. The other portion of that would be related to how we would inspect projects, the administrative part about managing the project. And in terms of the fixed cost would not change, but the variable, which means as we use consultants to help us manage our programs, as projects go up, the number of projects go up, we can use consultants to manage that increase in projects. But if those projects decide or are reduced, then we would cut back on the amount of consultants that we would have to manage the projects. So right now we are probably looking at about 60% or maybe 70% of our projects being managed with consultants. If those number of projects fall down because of the cut in the program, then the percentage of what we do in-house versus compared to the amount we contract for from a management perspective, our percentage internally will go up.
So you're not looking at any staffing reductions?
I would not
be
looking at a staff reduction, but rather to adjust the variable component, which, and I define that as the amount that we outsource to the private sector.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, and you know, the situation, and obviously you were here, Ms. Lane, that you experienced 3 years ago. This is such a dramatic drop off. I mean,
right.
we're talking about percentages. A swing of 100 million?
Okay. I'm not sure it'll be that big.
Yes.
Okay.
So it just means adjusting things either currently or into the six-year plan. Mr. Lawson, in January, I really would appreciate if we spend a lot of time walking through the maintenance budget. And I think it behooves us to truly understand that when you look at these numbers just critically, we're not spending anywhere near what we've been allocating, mm-hmm. which indicates there's certain challenges in spending the monies. And we'll, in January, at least have an idea about who and where we were after December 1st, where most of this year's contracts were supposed to be completed by. Is that correct?
December of this year, the contracts issued in 10 should be completed.
So my questions are, number one, we need to understand where the industry was as of December 1st. Second thing is that looking out, what really is should we be budgeting for maintenance? Given looking at these numbers, there's still not, there seems to be a delta between what we're allocating and budgeting and what's being spent, which raises some bigger questions as to whether or not we should be transferring as much money as we are from the TTF over to the HMOF. Last part of this is, as we have ramped up the spending for maintenance, what does that mean in the out years for the need for keeping that type of crossover going? Because you're putting what? You put $400 million into asphalt this year?
Yes.
You're going to put another $400 next year?
Next year would be reduced.
$300?
$350? It'll probably be more in the $250 range.
So right now, I mean, at least in some ways looking at this, we've just been automatically sending a certain increase every year from the TTF over to HMO.
Mr. Chairman?
And then the issue is what should that number be? And as we look out projecting, blindly taking percentages and moving it over increasingly every year. I just need to understand. I think the board needs to understand whether we need to do that. Dr. Davis.
Mr. Chairman, wasn't it true that this past year there was a huge escalation in paving, primarily because of the federal stimulus money had to be spent, and the only thing we could get it out in that time frame was for paving, and that we made a decision to advance a lot of paving, knowing that probably we would not be able to sustain that pace without those funds?
I think for our... We only did about 150?
Yeah, it was about 150, 160 in paving work.
The vast majority it was the issues on the audit and getting those balances down.
Okay.
So,
Chair?
Yes, Mr. King.
That question would be in relation to the budgeted amount for maintenance and the expended amount would indicate that we won't be meeting the targets we've set for our maintenance program. I know that it's a needs-based, and we've got certain targets we've got to meet. So would you anticipate we would meet those needs, or do you know if we would meet the needs with a lesser amount of money expended in the maintenance side?
Mr. Chairman, the interstate targets, I believe we hope to meet by, is it June 30th of 12? We expect to meet those with the current level of spending. We expect to meet that on June 30th at 12. On the primary system, I believe we are projecting to meet our targets by June of 13. And on the secondary, we said we hope to improve on the current level, but we didn't come out with a target amount that we could hit. So from the target perspective, that's where I think we are.
And you know, but Ms. Keene, it's issues like that, I think, and along with Dr. Davis's comment. I mean, I don't want to say we've been blindly, but we've pretty much been blindly transferring money, crossover, and ever increasing it without necessarily looking at what's happening underneath. And is the money being spent, and we see these balances continue to move up. Now, next year, Mr. Worley assures me that the balances will be dramatically less.
June 30th for 12, they will be dramatically less. As the presentation showed, we are expecting that to be, in the maintenance side, $100 million as compared to $500 million last June 30th, 11. June 30th, 10 was like, what, 580, 560?
530, I believe.
530, $530 million. We brought that down in June 30th, 11. We reduced that amount to, I think it was slightly below.
Just below 500.
500. And we are expecting in June 30th, 12, for that amount to be, the balance to be about $100 million. If you remember the presentation that we given some time ago, the best year we've had was probably in 2005, where the balance was like $16 million. And that's pretty good out of a $1.5, $1.6 billion budget. So $100 million, it's going to be close. And that's pretty good percentage of your total budget.
Mr. Chairman, would we say that the principal problem with getting that money out has to do with the scheduling of the contract process, or does it have to do with having adequate staff to get it out? What's the principal limitation to get out that $100 million?
So, Mr. Chairman,
well, you want to get it down to $100 million.
I think in the past it was the reason the balance was so high. We just were not aggressive in getting our contracts out. I don't think that had anything to do with staff. I think that was a philosophy on how we budget and how much we hold in reserves and contingencies, and that's what created. You slowed this big machine down. And these numbers just add up.
Yeah, and once you start thinking, if you think about the previous administration, thinking of maintenance contracts like you think of construction contracts.
Yes.
And move that through the contracting. There you start saying, okay, it has to be fully funded. And so money, you start, where you could have gone out and paid 5 miles, it's a 10-mile project, you could have gone 5 miles and 5 miles. You end up waiting until you got 10 miles worth of projects. You've got the whole thing. So once you start philosophically looking at a maintenance project like you do a construction project, it really started coming up, the process.
So I believe we have the staff available to get the projects on the street. And then the maintenance area, then you're looking at the weather.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Am I going to have a year of snow where we budget $130 million for snow? If we get through the end of the season and I don't have a need to use that, that's a balance where we now have to adjust. So then the question becomes, do we have on-call contracts in March, let's say the spring, and I don't think we need, we can use that snow budget, can I get contracts in place to start doing other maintenance type work with that $100 million if that's left over? So we are now getting on-call contracts in place so that when you do have maintenance reserves left over because we didn't have a bad winter, we can put that money to work. So we're doing things that I think is going to minimize the balance that you have at the end of the year. But there are a number of things that that will impact it. Now, I talked about a mild winter. So let's talk about then it's a bad winter. And my $100 million estimate and balance could just flip the other way. And I have a deficit that I have to adjust for and stop work on certain maintenance items. So there are just a number of things that impact that. And I believe when you get down to $50 million range, 50 to 75 million, you are really hitting it on the money at that point because it's very hard to bring this in at a zero level.
Mr. Chairman, is the procurement process as complicated for maintenance contracts as it is for construction contracts?
Mr. Chairman, a big part of the maintenance is in our assets and the pavement, and we run that through our construction division just like we run projects through. It's not as complicated as doing a construction project because you don't have the design that you have to worry about. But I think they got that down pretty in a pretty good science, and we know how to get those projects out. So. The other piece is just the operation side. And, we just have to get those contracts back in place so we can do the other maintenance work like mowing and litter pickup, et cetera.
And Felix, so that one of the things I'm trying to get after is, all right, so we've seen this influx of our money. We've seen this influx of money that in reducing these balances, and then generally looking at what we've been doing, we'll see the levels go up to a certain amount. And so the question becomes is that should we be transferring as much money from TTF over? And that question really hasn't been answered yet, and that's what I really like to focus on. If we bring our maintenance levels back, if we get the program back to where it should be, that is, every year maintaining a certain amount that keeps our system at the standard it should be kept at, then do we need to be transferring the amounts of money that we are? I question whether we do. I really do. So if we're bringing all of our interstate primary up and to a certain extent the secondary, that's just for pavement, and we do our other maintenance because, the paving is only $400 million of $1.9 billion in maintenance that's going out there, maintenance and operations. So I really think we need to look, and I think we're going to have to start looking at separating out operations versus maintenance. So we really do understand the numbers more, because sometimes I think we're not really getting a true picture because we're spending more money in maintenance. You think we're spending more on maintaining the infrastructure, and we're seeing more potentially going into operations. Not a problem, but I don't think we're getting a true picture.
Okay.
Mr. Pritter, now the DRPT.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I just wanted to take a moment today to give you all a quarterly update on our financial status at DRPT. Included, y'all should have a couple of reports, financial reports. One is for the quarter September 30th, and one is for June 30th, because we really didn't have a board meeting in August, and in September we didn't really have a workshop. So I'm going to mostly focus on the September 30th, but then touch on the budget to actual for last year for the full fiscal year, as it's always good to take a look at what actually happened. First, I guess the first statement in these reports, I just want to focus on that for a second. It's a statement that we call resources, commitments, and funding available. And I guess the main point I want to make to you as board members is the bottom line there is funds available. And basically we go through a large reconciliation process every quarter to take all our projects and all our commitments, match that up against all our revenues, resources, receivables, cash balances. And the net of that is the funding that we have available to actually progress projects on an off-cycle basis, meaning if you're out and someone has an immediate need or wants to progress a project not through our normal grant process in February, the normal six-year program process, January, February, March, April, May, but instead, next week, those are the balances that are available that you should keep in mind, that if there's something out there related to transit or rail, the potential exists. I will say that those balances, some of them are in buckets of funding that do have restrictions, so it's not money that can just be moved here or there. But anyway, that's the main purpose of this first schedule, and it does show there's a balance in rail and there's a balance in transit, and this is as of September 30th, because really this is a moving, it's a snapshot in time, and every day these balances are changing. Projects end, so they might have a small balance remaining, so the balances might be going up, or Director Drake does have the authority up to $200,000 to do a project of her own, or a project that's been brought to her attention by our staff, or maybe it's a budget adjustment or of an existing project. So these balances do change. This is a snapshot in time, so that's why I'm not going to focus on June 30th, because those balances are no longer, this is the best information available. But take that point with you, that in the back of your mind, if someone's asking about a project, there are funds available. The next slides, a few slides, and we'll talk about our cash balances. And basically, we determined on the rail side a 90-day working needs of cash, and then on the transit side, about a 60-day working needs. And that comes to about $60 million for transit, and as you can see, I guess the average is a six-month average of actual cash, and that average is right at the $60 million. But on the rail side, you can see we have about four times the cash that our working needs would dictate. And I guess essentially what's going on there, and I'll talk more about it later when we look at budget actual, but we have several large projects in rail that are large dollar and more complex. So predicting the actual cash outflows is a lot more difficult. And I think the last time I gave y'all an update, we talked about this, and then we did go to the six-year improvement program, and we changed a lot of the allocations in the program to match up to cash, anticipated cash outflows or expenditures. This just shows those cash balances graphically. I will point out there's sort of a spike going on there on the transit side, the lower blue line. And what's going on there is we had a in our agreements, our standard grant funding agreements each year, you know, we are constantly looking to have better oversight of our funds. So there's every year there's potential to amend those agreements. And this year we had an amendment to the agreement, and then several providers, transit providers, there was some pushback back and forth over that amendment. So there were some operating funds that built up the last 3 months. But I'm happy to say as of yesterday or Monday, that was worked through, and by the end of this week, probably about $20 million of that cash balance will be going out the door.
You sure they really want it?
Director Drake? I think most of the points here, I mentioned the spike in the first quarter due to the operating funds, and then the four times the target in rail. So this is just reiterating. I will say on rail, getting a little more detail, the Norfolk train project is about a $100 million project, and to date, we've actually expended about $1 million on that project. But
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious who the provider is that's hadn't billed 28% or whatever. If the work's been done,
well,
are they doing it for free?
Yeah.
Well,
thank you, though.
You know, like that famous movie.
Don't ask.
It's a failure to communicate.
I will add to that comment that we have added in our contract now that 90 days after completion, you have to bill us or we close it out, take the funds. So
this is the issue. I mean, we had made some amendments agreement, you know, and every year they make a different, we have the master agreement and amendments are made to it due to some issues involving some of the transit providers where we did not have the opportunity to have seats on their boards. We put in the agreement that where we are authorized to be on the seat, on these boards and commissions, that we should be able to be on them to see what's going on. This is primarily after a couple major problems, the Norfolk issue as well as Northern Virginia, the Metro. Everyone signed it except for one provider, and that's the folks at Northern Virginia. Now they have signed just this week.
Monday.
So after working out whatever their concerns were, so they have signed. And they have agreed that from now on, we will always have the ability to be on one of their boards of commissioners. In this case, specifically the Metro Board for Washington.
Next, I just want to take you through our budget to actual year to date. So this is a three-month snapshot for fiscal year 12. So we have the annual budget. I guess there's an error here. It should say fiscal year 12 budget there. And then the next column is 3 months of that budget. So I'm comparing 3 months of the budget to actual and then coming up with our variances. And I guess I'm not going to worry too much about the lower part, the lower three items here, but the top two, it ties back to our transit operating funds we spoke on that should be corrected by the end of this week. And then the rail programs, once again, the Norfolk passenger project. It is progressing. It is about 30% complete. It's just the billing, that, for whatever reason, is delayed. So by the end of the year, we hope we'll be closer. And, you know, I think as John, y'all talked with John earlier, I mean, for transit, we have over 1,000 projects. And essentially, our budget is based off of anticipated cash outflows or expenditures. So I'm not going to say we go through all 1,000 projects and do a cash flow, but the larger ones, we do that. But the issue there is 1,000 projects to try to anticipate when those outflows will happen. And on the rail side, there's a lot more complexity to get the project up and running. So, and maybe this is to Commissioner Worley's point, I think to some degree, it's never going to be perfect. It is just, we're estimating. So at the end of the year, and I think Commissioner Worley was hinting at this, that if you can get within 10%, at this variance column, that many projects, I think it's a fairly good effort at that point. So that's sort of our goal. We spoke on this. This just reiterates what I said as far as the variances. And finally, I just want to touch on the June 30th, and it's a lot of the same items. Transit did have a couple of issues. We substituted some ARRA funding on the Norfolk Light Rail project, which at the beginning of the year the budget had as a as an expenditure of state funds. Those funds didn't get spent until in July for the light rail project. We've gone through that issue with the Norfolk train. There was also issues with several other projects, Noakesville to Calverton, Berryville Elkton project. But as I said, we did re-rack the six-year program to try to mirror up to our anticipated cash outflows. And with that, this reiterates all of what I just said. Hearing y'all talk with John a little bit, I guess I just wanted to throw out that, you know, our budget is based off of anticipated expenditures, and then our six-year plan in the rail side, we've kind of moved to putting those allocations in the years where we anticipate the expenditures. But on the transit side, we're still in a mode of taking the current year revenues and taking those revenues and putting them on capital projects. So it might be that, I'll take a simple one, we take a bus purchase for $2 million for 5 buses, let's say. So we allocate $2 million in the year we're in, fiscal year 12, knowing that most likely that expenditure won't occur for 18 months to 2 years when the buses come in. And I just throw that out as food for thought to everybody here, because it sounds like, you know, we're starting to get in discussions about, you know, how budgets work and how six-year plan allocations work. And from sitting here listening, I think it might be a topic that we should discuss. I know for us internally, we have the transit side's done one way and the rail side's done another way, and it seems like it ought to be a consistent process. With that, I'll close. If there's any questions, I'll entertain them.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Today's presentation is on Virginia's adoption of the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, otherwise known as EMUTCD. A quick overview of what we'll talk about today. I'll give you a little background on what the EMUTCD is. We'll speak a little bit more about the Virginia supplement to the EMUTCD. We'll share with you our stakeholders' input process, and we'll review the Federal Highway compliance dates, where they were then and what they are today. We'll also talk about how we're managing the impact of the EMUTCD, and we wrap up with requests for the action items coming in December agenda. The EMUTCD is the national standard for all traffic control devices. It is administered by Federal Highway Administration, and it's applicable to all U.S. roadways. States are required to adopt it by 2012 under the code section that's listed there. The current version is 2009, and states are given 2 years to adopt it. This version has 9 parts, and they're listed there for your information. Now, Virginia has always had a supplement. Hasn't been updated in a while, so we took the opportunity to update the supplement. What it does is basically reconciles differences that are Virginia-specific with the national guidelines. For example, something may be called for in the national guidance, but in Virginia, our code may require something different. So we reconcile that and make it part of the supplement. It also gives more flexibility, especially in the area of work zone. We focus on Chapter 6 of that to help our localities with adapting the national guidance to something that would fit in a city, for example, or in a county. I also gave you a couple of pictures of examples of what Virginia's specific signs could be. We incorporate these as part of the supplement and make them more official. A little bit of history. The EMUTCD has evolved over the years. As you can see, this board has taken action on this. four times. The last time was in 2005.
Sure.
When we...
Yes, Ms. Lane.
Could you give an example what a deviation in Virginia would be from the national standards?
Sure. For example, the national standard, let's say they call for a sign, it would have a certain text on it. For example, the national standard says stop for pedestrians. In Virginia, the code tells us to yield to pedestrians, that kind of thing. It's really nothing.
No significant.
No.
Okay. Just curious.
All right. Oops, we're going the other way. Here we go. When we went to update our supplement, we had a very comprehensive outreach effort. We had 13 statewide committees. We involved localities, cities, counties, private industry, public, state agencies, sister agencies, I should say. And FHW was with us throughout the whole process, and they have approved our supplement, so that's a good news. Oops, keep going the wrong way.
Let's ask you a question regarding it. You know, you just can't help but notice that, you know, on average they were doing it every 10 years, and now in the last 10 years we've done it three times?
Mm-hmm. It actually evolves depending on the changes in safety and operation issues. They were actually... we don't have any control over when they update it.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying, isn't it kind of dopey?
That's my question. What's it?
I mean, how often do we have to keep on updating this and spending money?
Well,
and
you know, some states adopt the MTD automatically. Don't we? So, you know, there's
No. Just don't worry about the process.
Okay.
I'm looking at the feds. Essentially, we went every 10 to 15 years doing this thing, and all of a sudden, in the last 10 years, they've redone it three times. It sounds like they got a lot of people and not a lot to do.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if our partners from the feds are here today, but...
Well, why is it? I mean, I'm just...
Mr. Chairman, it may be that we've all become so much more visually attenuated.
We're not supposed to be distracted driving and looking at all these signs anyway. I'm sorry.
That growth in Northern Virginia, that government group.
I'm just making a comment.
Well, that was my question about the deviation. Can't we just say we agree? I mean, are they significant instead of spending a lot of time on, to your point, what seems to be pretty innocuous stuff?
Well, I just don't understand why they have to keep on updating it. And then they update it, we have to update it. I don't understand what you're saying.
Right.
But, go ahead.
Okay. Hold your own.
All right, let's talk about the compliance issues. You may recall when this first came out, there were some specific compliance issues, and which caused a lot of concern on a lot of people. FHWA recognized that those concerns and reopened the formal comment process back in November 2010. Most DOTs, as well as us, we responded, and our comments were summarized in these three bullets here. We basically requested either elimination or extension of the compliance dates, and more importantly, to allow us to use engineering judgment on when we replace these devices. And to the credit, FHWA listened, and they are just recently, August 2011, came back with the proposed elimination of 46 compliance dates and the extension of four, and I'll talk about those four in the next slide. One issue you may recall was street name signs. That issue no longer exists. That compliance date has been rescinded. All signs can stay until the end of their useful life.
Well, how much of this we think this was going to cost us to go out there and replace every
it would have been millions.
Single street sign?
It would have been millions. It would have been in the millions. I mean, it all depends on where each area, how long they replace them on a regular basis or not, but it would have been in the millions. Definitely.
Yes.
So they do listen.
Absurd.
Listen. All right. With
Mr.
removal
Chairman,
of all...
Yes, Mr. Lauterbar.
Maybe I'm missing something here, but why would street signs can remain until they reach the end of their useful life? I mean, are they going to change the street name or...
No. They had requirements where they wanted us to go in and increase the size of the lettering. Because of the Asian population, they felt an increase of the size of the lettering would be better read by our Asian population. So that's what was, and they had a specific compliance that we need to do in by.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this supposed to be corrected by driver's licenses by wearing glasses?
I'm glad to provide that humor for you this morning.
Seeing our dogs, what I think.
Well, I think that explains why they rescinded almost 46 of all these complaints because they recognize the impact.
And when your GPS is telling you turn right here, you're going to stop and go, look, let me look at the light, the street sign, right?
Well, wow. The reason I was asking that question, I was a little bit concerned. I wondered if we were going to start putting them in Spanish. And that was going to pose a little problem with me. But anyway, I was just asking.
Oh. Okay. As I mentioned earlier, with the removal of these compliance dates, we anticipate minimum impact on our maintenance and operation practices. I did mention earlier the date that were extended to 4 of them, and I put them in here just FYI in case you wanted to get a flavor of what we're talking about. Most of these things that have been extended, we already do or in the process of doing, so we don't see really any major impact. Plus, the dates that have been extended 5 years give us plenty of time. Some of these practices we already do. Basically to summarize that we will be giving more flexibility, using engineering judgment and different methodologies to be able to reach the compliance that they want over time.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Cohen.
Just a curiosity. Do these regulations apply to all our roads and
yes,
all our streets?
Yes, sir.
So let me just throw my 2 cents on top of yours. So the federal government's coming in to tell us on all our roads and all our streets, everywhere, no matter where it is, well, it's public, I guess.
Right.
That we needed to increase the lettering a little bit.
And this is what's great about
that's right.
Government.
They had this.
They can't balance their budget, so they're going to tell us what size letters to use.
All right, I could go on for days. But I'm just going to shut up.
Should I go on then?
But, you know, that's what's wrong. This is indicative of what's wrong.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think this is something that we need to bring up with our federal representatives. This is a place where they can cut back.
I already sent an email.
Crazy regulations.
I just sent the email.
The question that I have, too, is I get complaints from people in my district that there are too many signs. That they're saying, why is VDOT putting up all these signs? We don't need them.
I think it was part of the jobs bill, actually.
It was. Mr. Chairman, I think it's time to move on.
Yes, sir. All right.
Do we have any standards on how many signs? Can we stop the proliferation of some of these things? Maybe we'll save some money.
Yes, sir. We do have regulations on all signs. You'd be surprised at how many requests for signs we get from all different kinds of people and businesses all the time. But we do have strict regulations. Absolutely. We do say no more than we say yes.
Okay.
You'd be surprised.
Mr. Ellis, Mr. Jeffries?
Yes. I believe the change to Clearview font was
correct.
Federal.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
So you get to go back and update all the signs on the interstate and everything for Clearview font because of federal regulations.
All right, we have been communicating with our stakeholders, our localities throughout the whole process through direct information, through communication on our website and through publication. We will be conducting workshops for the MPOs and the localities if they need help with the changes that are coming with the same UTCD. And we'll keep examining our business practices to make sure that any changes will be built into our maintenance process, budget process. Whoops. To summarize, in December we'll be coming to you with basically 3 items. One is to adopt the MGTD and the supplement, and the next two are more of a housekeeping. The current regulations, there are 3 current regulations that concern the MGTD and the supplement and Chapter 6. Based on the recommendation of the OIG's office task force to streamline regulations, they have asked us to roll all 3 of them into one, so that's what the 2 bullet, and the last one would repeal the old regulations because they will no longer be needed. More information of that is in your packet if you need to. With that,
any questions?
Does this include electronic signage also?
Electronic signage, there is some guidance on electronic signage in the MC, yes.
I mean, because they're all locally controlled by local jurisdictions, and I'm just curious what happens if they're in violation. I guess the local jurisdiction controls.
Most of the electronic signs you're talking about, the one overhead that you see on the road.
No,
not the billboards. No.
Okay.
No.
No, I'm talking about signage like a city might put up that rotates through information.
Right. The city controls, but some of the cities have those as well, too.
Okay, yeah. Just want to make sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Developing improvements on I-81, Mr. Catewood.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Worley, members of the board. While Carol is queuing up the file here. Oh, I have it? I'll do that.
There it is.
I'll let Carol help me find it. I'll just introduce this just real briefly. Secretary and the Commissioner asked me just to give the board an update on some of the activities that we've had on the 81 corridor, really for about the last 15 to 20 years. And I think that the primary focus there was we've had a number of new members on the board that may not be familiar with some of what's gone on 81 in the past. And we also have a number of improvements that we've recently made as well as projects underway. Just to start, 81 is the longest interstate in Virginia, and it goes all the way from the Canadian border, which a lot of folks don't realize, and terminates near Knoxville, Tennessee. And it is one of the top trucking routes in the country. It carries somewhere between around 50 and 60,000 vehicles a day, and that traffic had doubled over about the last 20 years. And one of the things I'll talk about more in a minute is the truck volume is very high. I really like this slide. It's a little bit dated, but this shows the movement of tonnage of freight through our state. And the wider the band represents more tonnage of freight. And you can see clearly when you look at this map, we have two major freight corridors through the Commonwealth, the 95 corridor and the 81 corridor. The one that I'll also point out is 77, which sometimes gets overlooked because most of the traffic on 77 is from out of our state. But you can clearly see the dominance in freight of the 81 and 95 corridors. This is a graphic that we adapted from an article that was recently in the Roanoke Times, and it just compares the percentage of truck traffic on various interstates around the state. And you can see 81 is the highest, with just under a quarter of the total traffic being trucks, followed closely by 77. 95 is the next closest, and it's less than half of the percentage. When you think about that from an operational perspective, a truck takes up a lot more room on the highway, and they're also lower performing vehicles. So for the same level of traffic count, you get a lot more congestion and impacts to traffic with the higher truck percentages. So they take up more than their fair share of the road, so to speak. If I could only show you one slide today, it would be this one, because if there's anything that defines the 81 corridor, more than anything, it's the topography. And this is just a comparative map showing a cross-sectional view of 81 when compared to 95. And as you can see on 81, you have approximately six major climbs or elevation changes. The one I'm most familiar with is the climb that you have from the Roanoke area to the Christiansburg area, where you pick up about 1,500 feet of elevation over a fairly short distance. This has a significant impact on how the facility operates, just again, primarily due to the effect that this has on not only trucks, but a lot of other vehicles like recreational vehicles, people towing things, that are all affected greatly by the topography. Something that we often forget is that 81 is kind of the education corridor of the Commonwealth. Almost half of the students in the Commonwealth attend a school that's accessed primarily by 81. We have, of course, Virginia Tech, JMU, some of the faster growing schools, and there's about 30 other colleges and universities where 81 is a significant access. And this really affects us when you have the student move-ins or holidays or things related to the schools. Really does have a very measurable effect on traffic on the corridor. In the 90s, just going back looking a little bit of history, this is when traffic first started to become, I think, more noticeable and a concern to folks on the corridor. There was some increases in accidents, and just the percentage of trucks became more dominant, and folks started having some concerns about 81. And in the 90s, VDOT initiated a series of studies looking at potential widening of the corridor. We had a series of public meetings. And what this culminated in was some 1998 recommendations by the chief engineer to the CTB, recommending primarily improvements in the three shaded areas, or the five shaded areas you see on the screen, the Tennessee border, the 77-81 overlap in Withville, the Roanoke-Christiansburg area, the Harrisonburg-Stanton area, and then the Winchester area. This resulted in a series of projects being added to the six-year plan for the 99-2000 update of the plan. And I won't read all of the list, but I believe the one project of these that was fully completed was the widening at the Tennessee border in the Bristol district. Not too long after that, of course, we had the downturn in the economy at the dot-com bust and a lot of reductions in our plan. And so really what was once envisioned, I think, as a series of major widening projects became spot improvements primarily. Many of these were very important projects, though, and a couple I'll point out is the reconstruction of the interchange at Christiansburg that everybody going to Virginia Tech has driven through. And then you had the two major bridge projects in the Stanton District at the Maury River and Buffalo Creek, which were big projects that were very visible as they were going on. And then a host of other smaller improvement projects, and as I mentioned earlier, the widening to Exit 7. Another thing that we did during the same time frame that was probably less noticed, but in some ways perhaps as important, if not more important for safety, was some wholesale improvements to guardrail along the corridor. Truckers sometimes call 81 the alley because it's very narrow, and we used to have a big problem with trucks crossing over the median and having a head-on with a truck or a car going the other direction. So we have what's called narrow median guardrail in many areas along 81 now. It's a double-face rail to prevent vehicles from crossing the median. It's been very effective. Another big thing in the history of the corridor was the PPTA proposals that came in the early 2000s. And this was back when there was a concept to do a truck-separated facility for 81. There ended up being two competing proposals that were the one that we had selected to negotiate with ultimately withdrew. But under that concept, the entire corridor was going to be improved with a multi-billion dollar project, the road was going to be tolled, and a truck-only facility or a truck-separated facility would have been constructed. During the time this was going on, we had suspended work on the other projects that we had. A very important thing to come out of that effort, though, that was completed and is still really going to set the frame for the future of the corridor was a memorandum of understanding we entered into with the Federal Highway Administration where we agreed on how we would look at the corridor. And they agreed to a process that we call the Tier 1 and Tier 2 ROD process, where the Tier 1 environmental review attempted to set the overall configuration of lanes on the corridor. So, for example, would you have three or four lanes in the Christiansburg area? Did that for the entire length, and then it had five sections of independent utility where future work would be done to do the environmental work at a little finer level of detail. And that allowed us to get an overall view of the corridor and then come back and do more detailed work in the future. Some of the key findings of that study was that the traffic volume was projected to double by 2035. You would need at least one additional lane for the whole corridor, and then about 40% would need two additional lanes. And also rail was looked at, that rail could help, but rail alone would not solve the problems on 81. The CTB did a resolution in 2006 to adopt that Tier 1 study, and then directed VDOT to continue the short-term safety and operational improvement projects on 81, and then also directed DRPT to do a freight study. They also, as part of that resolution, authorized the two truck climbing lane projects, which are currently underway. One is in Rockbridge County that started first. It's about a $83 million project. And then the one in my district is a little over almost a $90 million project in Montgomery County going up Christiansburg Mountain. These were the two biggest climbs on the corridor where, again, the topography was creating a lot of congestion and operational issues. I won't read all these projects, but there are a number of projects on the horizon, interchange improvements at exit 150, and then turn lane, acceleration lanes, similar to what we've done in the past. I know in the Bristol district, the bridges over Scratch Gravel Road is going to be a major project just in terms of its traffic impact that's getting ready to start this fall. We're also going to continue with the safety and operational upgrades, signage, guardrail, things of that nature. Many of you are probably familiar with the curves in the Arcadia area. It's a very windy section coming down toward the Roanoke Valley. We're going to be working on the super elevations there. And then in the northern Shenandoah Valley, a number of safety improvements with the, basically the roadside configuration, trees, guardrails, and things of that nature. One other thing that really defines the 81 corridor that's a little different from some other interstates that's going to be a big issue in its future are the bridges. Because of the topography, 81 has more than its fair share of bridges. And unlike many of our other corridors, most of the bridges on 81 carry 81 over something. If you think about 95 and 64, most of the crossroads go over the interstate. On 81, 81 typically goes over the crossroad. I'm not really sure why it ended up that way. But we have a lot of 81 bridges over smaller roads rather than the other way around. And because of the truck traffic, maintenance and ultimate replacement of these bridges is a significant issue. The board has improved a number of projects throughout the corridor to make bridge improvements, and we certainly appreciate that. And that's going to be continue to be important on the corridor just to maintain what we have is working on those bridges. Pavement is the same way. The truck load certainly takes a toll on the pavement. As you all know, there was a major in-place recycling project in the Stanton District last year. Salem has the only concrete pavement on the corridor that's now been covered up, that we've done a significant investment to rehabilitate that concrete pavement by injecting polyurethane underneath of it to level out the slabs. We also have the two traffic management centers on the corridor with the message boards and cameras. Although this was the last corridor really to have this started in the state, I think we were able to take advantage of what was learned in the eastern part of the state and do a very robust deployment that's continuing to get more robust at a lot lower cost than some of the earlier centers in the eastern part of the state. So this is an area that I think I'm really pleased with, and where we've made a tremendous amount of progress even since I've been in Salem. A major project that's underway now is the Tier 2 work that I just mentioned, the Tier 1, Tier 2 process, underway on the 81-77 overlap in the Withville area. This is probably the most congested section on the corridor right now because those two interstates do share a common roadbed. That is anticipated to be complete next spring. Last specific item I'll mention with two slides is the 81 Corridor Coalition. This is a cooperative effort between the various states on the corridor, actually founded by a member of a local governing body in Pennsylvania who was concerned about safety on the corridor. Virginia houses the corridor at Virginia Tech, and we're getting ready to have the annual conference of that group in Blacksburg at the end of the month. The focus of that group is primarily how the various states can work more effectively together, get information to folks interested in projects on the corridor, also traffic impacts, with a particular focus on safety and incident management on the corridor. We have invited the members on the corridor to attend. Certainly anybody that wants to is welcome as well. Finally, just in closing, the operational projects that we have underway now and the truck climbing lanes will continue to enhance the operation and safety on the corridor. And there are a large number of bridges on the corridor in the plan if you were to look today. I have probably half a dozen in Salem, and I know there's a number of bridges either getting ready to start construction or in the planning phases in all three districts, and that's going to be important. When you look forward a little further out, as traffic continues to increase, I think going back to the chief engineer's recommendations from 1998, I think the board will need to consider additional improvements, probably some spot capacity improvements in those same areas that were identified in 98. I know that's really changed. And you would use the Tier 1 EIS to kind of guide those priorities and also what those would look like. I did my best to try to stick to my time limit, so I hope I did okay, and I will welcome any questions anyone might have of me.
Questions, Mr. Kaywood, Mr. Rich.
One thing I think might be helpful, I know Delegate Andy Guest told me 20 years ago, a great way to solve a problem here is to use the Norfolk and Southern. I think if we could get Norfolk and Southern in here to tell us how much truck traffic could be put on the trains, it might go a long way in solving this problem and have the private sector solve it, have Norfolk and Southern. I'd like us to look into that further just to see what we can do there. There are some estimates to say we could take, as I read here, maybe a million trucks off this highway, including 750,000 in Virginia, that could have an impact. So I think if maybe we could get Norfolk Southern in here. They may have a different idea now, but I'd love to hear what they have to say about this.
Certainly that would be a good idea. I know that the freight rail study that I mentioned earlier was completed. Kevin Page, if he's still here, might be able to speak to it in more detail. I think when you look at the corridor, Norfolk Southern is certainly making a lot of investments in moving containers on the corridor, and I think that's going to continue to be important. However, I would caution that if you look at just car traffic alone on the corridor, if you took all the trucks out, you're still going to need capacity improvements on 81 going forward. So I think the real issue with rail is what percentage of the trucks can you realistically draw off, because you're going to have some that are more local. But I certainly think that rail has a piece to play, but you can't overlook the passenger vehicle volumes as well.
Okay, two more questions. One, I don't see any numbers on this presentation. If we six or eight lane this thing, the last number I saw was $11 billion. So I think you need to make sure when you do these presentations, you make sure that the board is aware of the fiscal impact. And if we're going to do it by piecemeal, we need to know that, because there's a lot of money.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. If you were to do the whole corridor at once, it's a tremendous number. Probably north of the $11 billion would be my guess. I think the direction that the board has been heading for a number of years, going back to the resolutions they passed in 2006, was to look at more incremental improvements on the corridor, and that's actually consistent with what's in the six-year plan today. I think with the withdrawal of the PPTA proposal, I don't think, at least VDOT has not looked at it as one large project. It's over 300 miles of interstate. I think my recommendation would be the board to look at it in terms of where are your priorities. The whole corridor is not the same, and it probably can be improved through time.
Another quick point I'd like to make too is, I don't know if this is valid. Maybe you could comment on, or other experts could. But I'm told that in the urbanized areas, like Winchester, and Dr. Davis would know more about this than I do, but I've done this, that you have a lot of the local folks getting on 81 because the local infrastructure isn't that good, frankly, and it's a good way to get around the mess. And so that contributes to the problem, and maybe some funding to take care of some of the local roads. We'll get some of the local people off of there. So it can mainly be used for through traffic.
And Mr. Chairman, all we need is $230 million for 37 East, and that would relieve some of the...
There you go.
Somebody take that down. Get the metro.
Got numbers in that presentation.
Anyhow, we need to look at that.
I think that's certainly true. I think very much like the way 64 functions here in the Richmond area. It's heavily used by through traffic, but 81 is certainly heavily used by more local traffic in the urban area.
I don't know whether someone else had their hand up, Mr. Chairman.
It's what, Doctor?
I had a great pleasure in my first term to sit through dozens of hours of hearings on 81 as we considered some of these proposals, and heard a lot of discussion about rail in the Shenandoah Valley and how it could solve our problems. And yet, every time we tried to talk to any jurisdiction about the issue, huge objections to trains coming through their particular jurisdiction. And Norfolk Southern, as cooperative as they've been in so many ways, made it clear they didn't have the capital, nor does anybody have the capital other than the Commonwealth or the federal government to build the track capacity that's needed to take these trucks off the road the way that everybody talks about it. They're currently at capacity. They're running and trying to build capacity as fast as they can to deal with what they have right now. The cost to build rail in the Shenandoah Valley, by early estimates, was as expensive as improving Interstate 81, and it only solved about a third of the problem, because two-thirds of the problem had to do with cars and all the traffic that we have, where we are a main throughfare, not only for trucks, but for cars. And the whole issue that became quite clear out of all those hearings is that Virginia should not bear the burden of the cost of making these improvements on 81 because such a high percentage of the traffic is simply pass-through traffic. And we just need to have enough courage to step up and charge in some way, either through gas tax or tolls, the people that are using this road that don't live in Virginia. And we can do that so easily today with electronic tolling and all that it's really hard to understand why we haven't had any response. In the meantime, the safety issues continue to mount, and the problem gets worse and worse every day we don't do anything. The climbing lanes are wonderful. Some of the intersection improvements have been great. But honestly, this has to rise to a higher priority in the Commonwealth than it has. And everybody's trying to do their best, but it is limited by limited vision on the part of our current General Assembly as to the need for revenues to actually address this. I think the CTB has said over and over that we're ready and capable of offering some solutions if some revenue can be made available to begin the process. And it would have to be over 15 or 20 years. So if it were $11 billion, it wouldn't be over in 1 year. It would be spread over 20 years that the improvements would be made. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for doing this presentation to put back in our minds the fact that this, along with the many improvements in Hampton Roads, the I-95 corridor, are absolutely essential that we continue to make improvements.
Yes, Mr. Coleman.
One additional point, and then I have a question for you. It seems like the last time we were briefed by Norfolk Southern, this stuck in my mind. For each reduction of truck traffic in the 81 corridor by 10%, Norfolk Southern would need to double their freight rail capacity. So the translation of trucks off and trains, freight rail improvements is really, it's a huge investment to move even a small percentage of trucks. My question, though, is this. In your last slide where you talk about incremental capacity improvements, compared to slide 16 where we talk about the traffic volume doubling, 37% needs additional lane, other sections need more than one lane, and so forth. How do we square that from an engineering perspective? I understand this is driven by fiscal realities, perhaps, but I mean, from an engineering perspective, can you really incrementally improve this corridor, you know, one sort of piece of lane at a time? Or does that cause as many safety and other problems that as it attempts to solve?
No, I think you can. I think it's actually almost ideal for that, because if you look at the volumes, there are definitely some breaks in volume. So I think it's very good for that.
So the strategy would be to attack those high volume areas similar to the way we're attacking the truck climbing lane safety problems and so forth.
Yes, absolutely.
Given the problem, I mean, right now, given resources, we're just going to have to figure out how to take the bites out of this thing. And, you know, personally, if we can figure it out, I'd like to see if we just start to set aside a certain amount every year and just do mile by mile by mile by mile. You know, we are supporting the Crescent Corridor project, which is Norfolk Southern. But, you know, we got to remember the traffic that's going up and down 81 is peeling off into other areas. And so even though we are also supporting the intermodal facility there in Montgomery County, which we're currently in litigation, go along with Dr. Davis, that, you know, here's an opportunity. We're going to build an intermodal facility, potentially take trucks off the road, and we're getting sued by the locality to prevent us from taking those trucks off the road. And by turning to rail. The thing is that, you know, truckers, they have, quote unquote, an enormous degree, greater flexibility, which when you look at where the logistics trail is here, they move up and down that road. A lot of that truck traffic is coming from the Heartland. They come up, they go across Tennessee, they head up here, they cut across 64, they go down 77. I mean, it's not point A to point B. It's where the cargo's coming, where it's going. The truckers will always, no matter what we want to do on rail and how much we do invest in rail, there are a certain capacity, and they're only there for the long haul. Truckers are always going to be there, and they're continuing to grow because it has become the spine, the truck spine of the Northeast. is what it is.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Garcinski.
A question regarding the tolling. I know we've transferred a capability of tolling to the 95 corridor. Oh, can we initiate tolling on 81 as well? No.
Not unless it's linked specifically with a capacity. But there is a General Assembly requires a specific, they passed a law that says we have to actually go to the General Assembly and get their approval. There's one place in the state that CTV does not have explicit jurisdiction to, or explicit authority to go ahead and implement.
Mr. Chairman, we had it and they took it away from us.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Because we proposed the idea that we would suggest moving forward with the idea of tolling 81.
Okay, Ms. Kaywood, excellent.
Thank you.
Results of the local government survey. Mr. Brawl.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. I want to give you a quick briefing today on a survey we conducted of local governments this summer. The Secretary asked us to survey local governments on a variety of transportation issues following the release of the George Mason University Secondary Road study in June. The survey itself was comprised of 27 questions, covered a variety of issues in an enormous amount of detail. In your package today, you have a summary that includes the answers that we received for all 27 questions and a summary of the comments for each of those questions, since we provided lots of opportunity for detailed responses. In terms of responses, we received 124 responses from county government. The surveys, we didn't limit counties to one survey response per locality. So that number represents about 63% of the county governments in the state where VDOT conducts their maintenance. We separated out the town responses because the town relationship with VDOT is slightly different. Primarily, those towns are working through the counties when they're working with the department. In our survey, we targeted administrators and elected officials, and we were very pleased in our response that 75% of the responses were from either elected officials or administrators. We also found it interesting that about 50% of the county respondents were in the more urban parts of the state. They were within established MPO boundaries. One of the first questions in the survey asked local governments about their areas of concern with the condition of the secondary system. And for this and some of the other questions, I've broken out the responses between the counties and towns so that you'll see that there's a little bit different perspective between the counties and towns. As you would expect, the areas of the greatest concern were pavement and bridges, followed closely by drainage. Where you start to see some differences in the towns, you see a higher level of focus on drainage, primarily because those localities have, you know, closed systems where they're having to treat stormwater. You see more emphasis on signals and also on bicycle and pedestrian accommodations. And as you would expect, the counties have more emphasis and more concern about unpaved roads. We asked the question about, you know, considering the debate and the challenges at both the federal level and the state level about meeting transportation needs, where should we be placing our focus? Was it maintenance or construction? And then we provided an open-ended question to let them tell us if it was someplace different. The overwhelming response was in maintenance. If you're interested in the 20% of the respondents that said other, most of those other responses said both.
This was not a fiscally constrained answer, was it?
No. That's why we were trying to get them to one or the other, but they 20% said both. We asked them their familiarity with a number of concepts that were pointed out and related to the George Mason study, with the ranking of 1 being very knowledgeable and 5 being not familiar. You can see the ratings for both counties and towns. The areas that they were most familiar with were the VDOT Devolution Guidebook and Secondary Model that was published in 2007 by the department, followed closely by the George Mason Secondary Road Study. We asked them, actually, one question in 2 different ways. We asked them, as of today, what was their level of interest in taking on a more significant role in transportation? We asked them that question if they were, you know, would they be interested in taking a greater role if there were no additional resources available? And then we asked them, what their level of interest would be if there were additional resources available. And as you can tell by the chart, the darker purple is with additional resources, and as additional resources became available, certainly there was more interest in taking on a stronger role. We asked them as a follow-up to that question what they felt like the best way to provide additional resources to the local transportation program would be. About 70% of the respondents, or what you see in the kind of light blue, purple color on the screen, is at the state level. But I thought it was equally interesting that about 25% of the respondents indicated that providing additional revenue options at the local level would be the best way to provide additional resources. We did ask some very specific questions about the George Mason University study. There were a series of options that were presented to the board in their strategic planning retreat last month by Dr. Jonathan Gifford. We asked them specifically what options they would be open to considering straight from that study. And as you can tell, the predominant response was enhanced budgetary priority for secondary road construction and maintenance. It was also interesting that the counties, to a lesser degree, showed some interest in performance-based maintenance contracting, local option transportation taxes as well. Finally, one of the last questions that we asked in the survey was, given your current organization and staffing, how could you rank your ability to provide transportation services to your community based on what you have in place today? The dark purple color on the screen represents about 75% of the responses where the counties indicated that their ability to do so was poor. We got a lot of comments on that particular question, and it really is reflective of the fact that VDOT's taken care of the system for so long for them. Certainly, that's just the highest of high points of the survey, but I would be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I just have a comment. It seems to me that we've already determined we need revenues, and we've already determined we know who's going to pay for it, that is the taxpayer. The only question we're arguing about is what level of government's going to collect the money. And I know in our legislative package we've pointed out a couple times the need and what have you. Is there anything else we can do?
Well, I mean, part of the, it's maybe a deeper problem, at least from the state's perspective. Should the state be plowing cul-de-sacs in Fairfax County? It is about this issue about roles and responsibilities.
Right.
And should we be instead focusing on the primary transportation
system? I don't think we
that
just
really is the key towards congestion relief and dealing with economic development and mobility. And I think there is we look back at how the system evolved 80 years ago, the Virginia of 80 years ago,
not
a very, very different system. And how it's evolved, you got to raise questions. I mean, one of the things about this question about maintenance equity you're looking at is, there's different parts of right near Landmark Mall up in Northern Virginia, and you go, why is it on this side of the street, it's Arlington, they get 16 or 17,000, on this side of the street, it's the city of Alexandria, they get 12 or 13,000, and why we only put in 5,000 into the system we have. I mean, this is a lot of crazy stuff that evolved over time that no one's had the courage to actually take a look at. Because if you do, you end up on the front page of the Virginia Municipal League newsletter saying that we're out proposing, we're going to vote on it this meeting.
I would encourage you to continue to do that.
They didn't have my picture. That's the thing.
I wanted to bring two things. This is not just a question that the CTB is considering. Obviously, there's a lot of business groups that have looked at that, not only in Northern Virginia, but now the Virginia State Chamber of Commerce has a transportation subcommittee that's trying to look at financing options and so forth. I would also call the attention of my colleagues to the Blue Ribbon Commission on Transportation Funding that Maryland has formed, and there's a series of draft recommendations there. you know, our system and Maryland's are not the same, certainly, but they begin to tackle exactly these set of questions with a couple of dozen sort of draft recommendations, including additional revenue options for localities, better priority setting for the statewide system, and so forth. So there's a lot of thought that's out there at the moment, because I think everybody sees that the federal government's uncertainty, state government's uncertainty, and local government's uncertainty, you still have to be able to execute something at some level. So I would recommend you take a look at that and just see if some of those things appeal to you as potential solutions and potentially things we might be able to talk about with our own General Assembly over the next few months.
Any other questions? Yes,
Mr. Chairman, I realize our responsibilities largely are on policy formulation and allocation of scarce resources to important projects. But it would seem to me on this secondary road issue that we might have to take on more responsibility for re-educating the public and particularly local leaders to what's happening around the country, because I've found in talking to a number of people in Virginia, they don't realize that we're the exception rather than the rule as to how we approach handling secondary roads. And I have had the unique opportunity, as I told you before, to talk to Senator Byrd about his father's role when they originally set it up so that we had central control of secondary roads. And I think that there could probably be a series of conferences held for local leaders and even for citizens to help educate them a little more broadly to how it is done around the country. If we were to try to move forward with any particular change or recommendation of a change, I think it would be catastrophic in terms of the reaction to it without that educational process. So,
Mr. Richard.
I agree with Dr. Davis, but I think Aubrey has hit the nail on the head. This is all boils down to revenues. And we've got a Dillon rule state. Our localities are not allowed to do much. So what they're left with is putting it on your home. And taxpayers are having trouble paying the mortgage. So we've got, if we're going to give them this responsibility, they're going to have to allow them to raise sales tax or something. And, you know, so that's part of the problem, I think.
Well, but then part of the problem is also situations like this. 2 weeks ago, the Fairfax Board of Supervisors voted to, I think, increase the density in Tysons by sevenfold. And in response to the discussion about the fact that they're going to need $1 billion to increase or to enhance the transportation road infrastructure, this discussion said, we don't have any worry about it. It's the state's responsibility. Mm-hmm. And there's tapes saying that. So when we think of secondary roads, you know, when Senator Byrd and Governor Byrd, when they went out there and looked at this issue, they were looking at rural country roads. They weren't looking at, cities like Tysons Corner. And you have to then question also, why do we have in the Hampton Roads area, everything is a municipality, and they all run their own roads with payments from us.
Right.
So we have if I remember it correctly, since I'm from up there, out of the three of the top 10 most wealthy jurisdictions in the country, and we are plowing their streets every time it snows. But the town of Dumfries is one of the poorest in the Commonwealth. With 3,500 people, we make them take care of their roads.
Mr. Chairman, the policy issue there is our responsibility, as I see it, to begin to address some of those issues. It'd probably be like 81. It probably won't be able to be done in a whole policy statement about what happens to all secondary roads, but it very well could be to separate urban secondary from rural secondary as far as a number of policies and funding allocations as controversial as it would be. It really needs to be addressed.
Yes. This is what this is all about, having this discussion.
But sir, isn't Tyson's Corner, though, and Tidewater, those are the economic engines. The amount of money they send down to Richmond.
Well, maybe on the general revenue side, but not on the transportation side, because I think every study shows they're actually, since we're a special fund and we get no general revenues, which I thought was kind of interesting, because the people who fight us the most about taking general revenues and moving on to transportation are the same people, they're saying they're the economic engine in Northern Virginia. And I'll just point out that we quite clearly show that we put more money out of our special fund into Northern Virginia than it's collected. In fact, the rest of the state is actually subsidizing Northern Virginia. Yes, just as
I just wanted to have a perspective of a Northern Virginian who was not a member of the Senate of Virginia. Because I think what you've said is certainly true about some of our representatives. But also, what Northern Virginia is in the middle of now is realizing not just that it's an economic engine, but with that goes leadership, goes creative thinking and innovation in these things. And you're right. There's a tendency by some in local government in Northern Virginia to run to the protection of Richmond won't let us, or that's Richmond's responsibility whenever it's convenient, and then to come out when it's convenient and say, wait, we know what we're doing. We don't need that help. We don't want any interference in our business. So that's the mark, actually, of a sort of a teenage maturing that it's of two minds at the same time. Yes, we're part of Virginia, but no, we don't want Virginia to control what we do because we're smart. We know what we do. So the key for us, I think, is as leaders in the state and in the regions, is to help people understand it's the same discussion. It's really not a discussion of a region versus the state. It is about striking the new balance that's required between fast-growing urban areas, you know, rural areas that have special needs, emerging economic centers, and restructuring the relationship with the state and with the locality. So I don't see that as some type of ideological or religious discussion where you have to line up and, you know, the acolytes come out and it's all done. It really should be a pragmatic discussion, and I think we can help drive it.
Yep.
For Northern Virginia, if you look at this chart, the results of your, you know, what would you do, enhance budgetary authority, empower counties, et cetera, I mean, you can clearly see three Northern Virginia counties at least, Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William, their voices are really showing up there. And I think if we can come to grips with particularly how to deal with the challenges in those three places, we might actually solve a large part of this uncertainty that's before us at the moment.
I might summarize, going back to Dr. Davis' point, we're really getting at, clearly, Mr. Miller and I were talking about this, clearly these rules were written at a time when they did not foresee limited resources, many of them. If you look at some of the rules of how we fund maintenance and different things and the waterfalls, it always implied that we were going to have. That's not the case anymore. Obviously, an incremental approach is what we're going to have to take. And that's really where I would say I was asking what we can do, because the conversation is not that. The conversation is we're going to get it, but we're not going to get it. We have to realize we're not going to get it if we don't increase revenues, and that, notwithstanding all the efficiencies we can do. And that's maybe it's back to education. Maybe it's your point, Doug, about, you know, how we lead that conversation, because it's not framed in those terms.
And I'm not disagreeing with this plan. The only thing I just want to hark back to our presentation at the retreat about what if you were to increase revenues by $500 million?
Right.
What would that mean? And you throw it back into the formula, and it means, you know, nothing.
Right.
It means nothing.
Right.
So you sit there and you got to step back and kind of go, I mean, again, all these things were all, you know, essentially sacred cows that we got to take a look at and understand, because it's more than just a revenue number now. It is about roles and responsibilities and kind of really taking a look at what's best for the future of the Commonwealth.
Right.
And particularly when we, you know, when I look at the state and the state's responsibilities,
I got projects like, you know, looking at major problems of major, you know, corridors of statewide significance, such as 81, where we're talking billions of dollars to make, you know, just add a lane. So, yes, Mr. Miller.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. As we're, you know, we're moving into the next agenda item, but they're all sort of related to this survey. And Dr. Davis, I thought, brought up some good points in terms of, and made me think about it a little differently. The charge of the next item was about equity. And equity was defined as not something in terms of we are situated differently necessarily, but the concept was basically, you know, how do you treat the city like the town, like the county, like the, how do you treat dissimilar groups the same?
We might skip that discussion with there would be handouts that would be helpful in that discussion, I think, be a part of if the chairman wants to go to the next item.
Was there any more questions?
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is perhaps, because as I've been looking at sort of this question, I looked at it in terms of the charge, which was equity, as opposed to maybe it doesn't need to be equitable. Maybe it's not supposed to be equitable. Or at least the criteria that we use to define equity is not the criteria that we would normally use to define equity. So as we sort of launch into that, we ought to keep that in mind. What is, because roles and responsibilities can be different, depends on where you're situated. And, you know, maybe that we need to treat people differently, not the same. And I don't know what I think about that. I don't really want to get into sort of a, Fairfax has more money, so they got to pull more of their own weight, and Portsmouth doesn't, so the state needs to pay for their weight. You know, I mean, that gets us, that's a slippery slope as well. And it has not been our history in funding. But citizens don't care whether it's the gas tax or the real estate tax or the sales tax or whatever tax it is. It's money out of their pocket. That's all that really comes to the end of the day. And if they're not willing to give more money out of their pockets, no matter what tax, fee, levy, toll, whatever you call it, then they're not willing to give more money out of their pockets, and they got to suffer the consequences.
Could have Occupy VDOT, I'm guessing.
Any other questions? Any other issues here? Let's go to the next presentation.
Mr. Chairman, let me
preface
the presentation. But yeah, I think we owe the committee needs to thank Dr. Davis for his analysis of the options, I think, that the committee had as we looked at this issue. But I want to begin by saying that I think too often we overlook the fact that Virginia is ranked the number one state in the union to do business. And that's something that's not just bestowed upon you. I think you earned that through your performance. And infrastructure conditions and performance is certainly a major part, a major contributor to that number one status. And so it's very important, I think, that we recognize that we have maintained roads in this area. Condition that would permit us to achieve that level of accomplishment. So, you know, the maintenance of our infrastructure, the maintenance of roads is a very important item. The committee that took a look at this issue analyzed many different models and processes,
mm-hmm.
and we've had an integrated education process for many of us. We took a most recent meeting, well, not today, but earlier in the week, a look at the VDOT budget development process to use this feed. Needs-based process and did some comparing that to the other process. And I think we came out with a new appreciation of the needs-based process of developing the budget. Even though it may need tweaking and does need tweaking, it's certainly a good model. It's one that's been validated by the auditing of the state and so forth. One thing we all did agree on is that we have state assets that have to be maintained. And it's a matter of getting that right balance. So as Jennifer makes this presentation of three bullets, that are not heavily loaded bullets, or as our recommendations to the board, and I thank the committee, Mr. Miller, Mr. Lovebach, and Mr. Garzinski, as we tried to work on this problem. And we did have some handouts and didn't have time to get it in the program. So, Jennifer. Okay.
Now, before you go into this, is there anybody here from BML? Come on, fess up.
Yeah.
Okay, so just for the record, this is an administration proposal. We haven't proposed anything. So when you actually go back and write up about this, can you be accurate this time?
You made the whip report.
Make sure you got my good side. Jennifer.
Turn around.
All right, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, I'm pleased to give you a report on behalf of the subcommittee on maintenance payments. Just to give you a little background, and some of these slides are going to be a little familiar because we shared them last month with you as well. Just reflecting back, back in June when we approved the local maintenance payments for fiscal year 12, there was a lot of discussion about how maintenance funds were distributed across the systems and across the localities. In July, you came back and adopted a resolution which established a subcommittee comprised of the at-large members of the board to look at issues surrounding equalization of maintenance fund allocation and to look and see what options we had administratively and legislatively to address that equity issue. Since that time, the subcommittee has met four times, most recently at 9 o'clock this morning, to finalize their recommendations. So we apologize for not getting it to you earlier, but we literally finished 10 minutes before the board meeting started today. When we met in August, and I've got a little demonstration, the at-large members have got back problems now from carrying around this notebook full of background information that we went over in August. We looked at the existing programs and all the available data that we had to reflect the code requirements, how funds were currently being budgeted in FY12, what local expenditure data we had for the most recent fiscal year, and the available local performance data. We also looked at a number of prior studies and evaluations of local maintenance payments going back to the mid-1980s, and we also provided some information on the devolution studies at that time as well. In September, we started diving a little bit deeper, looking at the different VDOT business models for maintenance. We had a number of handouts associated with this, and we gave you copies of those at your September strategic planning workshop. But we did a basic comparison of the different maintenance programs, their payment categories, the rate structure, and what their budgeted rates were for the current fiscal year. We also looked at local system maintenance funding policy in other states, and as has already been mentioned today, we're very unique, and it's hard to find anything that compares to how Virginia system works. The thing that was a little bit comforting is we didn't really find anybody that has had a better solution or something that brought innovation to the table in looking at the 10 other states that we did. And we also provided a matrix of administrative and legislative opportunities that the board has at its disposal in dealing with maintenance payments. In October, the meeting that was actually last Tuesday, as Mr. Keene mentioned already, we had a presentation by Connie Sorrell on VDOT's asset management approach to maintenance budgeting, and it really was kind of a transition moment for the committee because they started focusing more on need and system condition than on different ways to calculate payments. And at that meeting, we also provided a number of scenarios, between 10 and 12 scenarios, looking at how local maintenance funds could be distributed differently. This is where, as the chairman has pointed out, there was a significant amount of interest from local government and from BML on those different scenarios. You have those in your packet in front of you now, but we looked at things like lane mileage, density of travel via vehicle miles traveled, truck traffic, and various combinations. We also tried to look at some economic factors like sales tax receipts, had difficulty getting data to develop those scenarios in any great detail. We also discussed some other potential factors where impacted the ability to provide maintenance and looked at things like snow, ice, and emergency operations. The information we had from local government on those factors was a little limited. We met this morning to basically bring together the three prior meetings into a slate of potential recommendations, and the general consensus and recommendations of the subcommittee are as follows. An analysis and comparison of needs across the systems is really desired before recommending any legislative changes. As I indicated, Mr. Rell's presentation last week was really eye-opening in the level of detail that we have data on the VDOT maintained system, but the type of data and information on local system condition and performance is fairly limited to a couple of performance measures, primarily bridge condition and one factor of pavement condition, really limits our ability to look at things on a needs-based based approach.
Mr. Chairman, and how many jurisdictions is that?
There are 83 localities in the Commonwealth that maintain their own infrastructure.
In two counties.
So it is the majority of the 83 that you don't have data on.
It's 81 cities and towns in two counties. So, yes.
Cities and towns, urban system.
Urban system.
That's your two counties, and then we have data for the 93 counties and all the towns that we maintain the system on. The committee spent a lot of time this morning talking about the second bullet, that the most equitable approach to distribution of scarce maintenance funding may be a formula that incorporates a prioritized needs-based factor. And when we talked about needs-based factor, it wasn't just so much system condition, but it was also performance, what kind of traffic those roads serve, what kind of economic generators that those highways serve, along with a commitment to maintain statewide assets regardless of maintenance responsibility. So looking at everything as a level playing field across all systems. The final recommendation is to reconvene a local government working group. We had a working group from roughly late 2004 through 2007 that was looking at financial reporting and reporting of performance data on the local system. We had that working group in partnership with the Virginia Municipal League and the Virginia First Cities Coalition reconvene that work group to advance the collection and analysis of system condition and performance data on the locally maintained system in a fashion that can be compared apples to apples to what we have on the VDOT maintained system.
Mr. Thurl.
On the when you talk about the needs-based, I remember going back to when we were discussing maintenance, not this time, but a few meetings past, we do an assessment every year where we're looking at the condition of roads and where we have deficient pavement.
Mm-hmm.
Can't we utilize that to determine needs-based? Here we have a deficiency, we need to put the resources here. Tomorrow we have a deficiency there, we need to put the resources there. Why doesn't that system work if it's telling us what our deficient pavement is?
We have that condition data on the VDOT maintained system. Where we can't make the comparison is to the locals, because the localities have different approaches to managing their assets and different types and formats of condition and performance data for their system. So we can look at VDOT system that way, but we can't look at the locals in the same fashion.
We have to gather that data.
Correct.
That's the recommendation.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
the other thing when we got into analyzing even the VDOT budget as far as the needs based, the total needs stated in the budget, I had a little difficulty myself, and I think other members did too, is correlating that number with numbers that we've heard about the needs in our system. The need stated here, the total need, is the need to meet the targets that we have set, for performance targets, not the need that has been collected throughout our system. So there's really a delineation that's needed in identifying that number as well. But the needs is a lot greater than what is stated in our budget. But this is what it takes to meet that standard of performance that's expected, that the commissioner expected to meet.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the formula used for those communities that maintain their own roads, for 81 of them, it's the same formula. So much for primary, so much for secondary or urban, however that's specified. And then, but then for the two counties, it's a different formula which provides additional funding above what the cities get.
For the urban cities and towns, the 81 that maintain their infrastructure, there's two rates that are established by code. One is for arterials, which roughly correlates with primary, and one for collectors and locals.
And that's the same across all 81?
And that's the same across all 81. For Arlington and Henrico, there are base rates established by code for each of those localities. The criteria by which you qualify for payment and how those payments are calculated is a little different and less formulaic.
Why wouldn't they be associated with the same that the 81 are? I mean, if it's both, they do it.
No,
I understand the code says it, but, I mean, unless somebody addresses the code and says, hey, this might need to be fixed so that the two are the same as the 81, then we just sit there and say the code says that and march on our happy way and deal with the problems.
Oh.
Ms. Gorsinski.
As one of the members of the subcommittee, I would address it this way, Cord, that we thought that the needs-based assessment, prioritized needs-based assessment, that ties in some of the things that Jennifer talked about, really had to be the first step before saying, well, let's fix Henrico and Arlington to be the same as everybody else. That doesn't really fix the system or make the formula right. And we were trying to get at the genesis of the real problem, is that the way the funds are distributed is not really facing the needs that we have throughout the Commonwealth, especially when you prioritize them to where, for instance, some roads are generating economic resources of the Commonwealth that others aren't. We used an example. Shep lives on a road that has three people on it. There's another road that has 30,000, but yet there's really no priority as to his road getting fixed, maintained, versus that other one. And so that's why we went back to, let's get the information first before we go running off to the General Assembly and let's say, let's fix this aberration of Henrico and Arlington. And that was, I think, Jim, if you, as our chairman, why we approached it that way, rather than just doing piecemeal, let's fix this, let's fix that. Let's look at the whole system and make it right.
So it would be rather December meeting?
Right,
Mr.
December meeting.
Mr. Lane, then Mr. Miller.
I assume that that legislative action is favorable to those two localities in terms of allocation?
No. The current one.
Current one is.
One is, one isn't.
Okay, so they would be impacted with a change.
One would be positively impacted and the other would be negative.
One would be slightly positively impacted, the other would be pretty negatively impacted.
Just like when we looked at the breakdown on some of these other ways to construct the formula, we ended up with, no matter what we looked at, one-third of the urban was favorable, the other two-thirds were unfavorable. So that was creating another monster as well. So,
Chairman.
Mr. Miller, then Mr.
Goulet. One, I'd like to thank our chairman who did a great job, I think, of keeping us pointed in the right direction. As I looked at this, and I've been vocal about it, I saw sort of three major things that didn't make sense to me in terms of how we do things now. The first was, we talked about the VDOT system is based on an assessment, a goal and an assessment in terms of whether we're reaching that goal, and so it was needs-based. And RICO and Arlington were set by statute that may have had something to do with needs some time ago, but
80 years ago,
but are not in correlation to similarly situated localities. And then the cities and towns had a third system, which was basically all lane miles. Didn't matter how many trucks, didn't matter how many cars, didn't matter, you know, nothing else mattered, just the miles of lanes. So you could have a situation where you had a lot of miles but not a lot of traffic, and they got more money than a place that had fewer miles and a ton of traffic, and it had more need, if you will, based on the targets. And that didn't make sense to me. So I think the first bullet that we had, which was, let's get some needs data. If we're going to use needs, then let's get some needs data, look at everybody's needs, and then sort of come up with numbers that deal with the need, not just how many miles of road there are. You know, don't fix it unless it needs fixing. When it needs fixing, fix it. The second thing was, there's a divergence between what I call critical need and sort of ordinary need. And I use the example that Mr. Garzinski used. I've got a road, it's in bad shape, it's got three families that live on it, it's about a mile long, it's mostly me. You know, on a strict needs basis, you could make the case that it needs to be fixed. But when you compare it to 64 that's got potholes that'll swallow your tire and break your wheel, I think we fix that first and the other one second. So there's really no sort of, as we divvy up the money, we add up everybody's on the needs side anyway, we add up everybody's quote need, we divide it by the total number of dollars, we determine that by district, and we send them the money. And so if you have a district that's got lots of critical needs, meaning they need to be fixed now, they could be getting less money than they need, than they should have, while other districts that have sort of ongoing but ordinary needs are getting money to fix ordinary stuff. So you got the critical care patient that's getting basically the same care as the ordinary patient. That doesn't make sense to me either. And then the final thing was, there's nothing in the system that goes to the value of the road. And I'm not a fan of devolution, and I'm not a fan of abandoning state assets. I think we were clear in the presentation. But again, to my example, my little road that's a mile long that serves three families does not bring a ton of value to the Commonwealth, not relative to some other road, some other place. And so as we're divvying up the people's resources, their tax dollars, why should that road that doesn't really have any commerce on it, that doesn't really serve some, you know, something that generates economics or safety or health or something, why does it get an equal share, if you will? That makes no sense to me. So if I was I think the recommendations are good, and we support them unanimously. But for me, I'd look at the needs across the state. I'd determine whether those needs were critical or not. I'd serve the critical ones first, and within each group, whether they were critical or ordinary, I'd say, which ones give me the best return? Which ones bring the greatest value to the person putting the money in? And that would be at the top of my list. And I wouldn't care what district they're in. I wouldn't care anything else. I mean, I just say we got limited resources, and we're going to put our limited resources to the place where it brings the most value and is needed the most. I think we're going in that direction by these recommendations. But that is what I see is wrong with the system as it stands now.
And, you know, just to remind everyone, too, I mean, part of the reason this discussion even started was the fact that, you know, we're looking at the secondary system continuing to deteriorate. You know, it is an issue of resources, and you have to step back and say, you know, because of the way the system has evolved, whether we are acts of omission or commission, we are devolving. And if you're quote unquote unlucky enough to live in a county, we are responsible for your secondary roads. You're the first ones. You're on the front line of that.
Mr. Chairman, the last thing I would say, we need to be careful about it, and I talked about it after our meeting. A lot of cities are putting in a lot of extra money into their own system.
Yeah.
And they should not be held, that should not be an unfair disadvantage to them. By this I mean, if I fix my own problem with my own local money, and you tell me I don't have a need anymore because I fixed it with my own money, so I'm not going to give you any of yours, that shouldn't happen. You know, that sort of goes to, you get shafted for doing the right thing. You get rewarded if you don't use your own money.
Well, it's sort of like revenue sharing for maintenance.
Yeah.
Which maybe is something we should think about. I'm sorry, the School of Maintenance, Dr. Davis.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Mr. Stone.
First of all, let me just say I've enjoyed absorbing the subcommittee's work, and I think you did arrive at the right place. The Assembly has made it clear to us through its requirement that we have an asset management program that we actually do not continue the way we have been doing on maintenance. I believe Mr. Rell is due to put together the report this fall again, which we will send to the General Assembly. Here's really the needs of the system. So we've gotten that part pretty well. What we haven't been able to do so far is actually pay attention to the conclusions of that report and then respond sort of in a rational way. So as a result, you have, for example, Northern Virginia has the largest percentage of its road network that's below standard at the moment. So, I mean, I'm paying attention to this. Performance measures that you've recommended we follow help correct that, because, as you say, you begin to direct the maintenance dollars to the most critical needs. But I would say this.
That also gives us the mechanism to make the larger changes if we see them, or the Assembly sees them, to special Henrico or Arlington situation. But it needs to be done, as has been suggested, within that broader context. They're already there. They just haven't, the Assembly hasn't followed through on their own direction, and we haven't fully followed through on that direction either. So I think we're on the right path myself. What you mentioned, Mr. Secretary, though, is the longer-term problem.
Yeah.
And that's not only how do we get the roles and responsibilities things sorted out, but how we tap into the resources. Let me just say this: the great resources that exist in Northern Virginia, in Hampton Roads, and in every part of our Commonwealth to actually do what we think is important. We just have a lot of barriers there. I heard on the way down this morning, Northern Virginia is now the richest per household income in the United States. This shouldn't be a battle about who's going to get whose money. We have the funds in Northern Virginia to take care of our own needs. What we need is leadership to see whether we construct a solution at the local level, at the regional level, or the state level. Still has to come from Northern Virginia. And I would challenge my colleagues, and still has to come from your localities, your region. It's a lack of leadership on this set of issues. It's a lack of follow-through on what we already know and have documented and what we need to do. So I would just say let's get on with it. All of us.
Yeah, Sterling.
We've all heard the statement that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. You know, we've got a problem. We've got scarce resources. We've got a lot of needs. We have to identify. I like the idea of going to a needs-based system where we can identify what the highest priorities are, allocate resources based on the needs to meet those priorities. But we've got to get there. Now, you made the statement, we've got to get on with it. We do. We've been talking about this since I've been on the board. And continuing to talk about it is doing the same thing over and over again. We've got to read. We've got to set deadlines, whatever it takes, to read when we're going to address this, come up with a set of recommendations to present to the General Assembly. Here's what they are. Given the scarce resources we have, it's always great to send them a report saying, well, we need some extra money. But if the extra money isn't coming, again, saying the same thing over and over again, it's not going to address the issue. We got to tell them also what we need to do in the allocation of the resources that we get that we're currently hamstrung on because of different pieces of legislation that are 80 years old. We've got to tell them these changes need to take place in order for us to use the scarce resources to the greatest benefit to the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we need to set deadlines, not talk about, well, let's get on with it. Let's get on with it. Let's set deadlines. Let's come up with a set of recommendations, present them to the General Assembly. Hopefully we'll see some action, and then we can move on with the management of the resources we have. We can still talk about getting additional resources, but we also have to effectively manage those resources we have, because one of the critical complaints you will get from the citizenry at large is when they see, you know, we talk about paving a road with three people on it or paving a road that maybe didn't need it, but that's where the money was and that's how we did it. Well, that gets people thinking, you don't need more money, you need to use your money better. So we got to use our money better to hit the needs so that we are showing people that we will use the resources entrusted to us to the greatest benefit for the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Okay, well, on that note, and that's a good time to break right here. Is everyone okay with the recommendations of the subcommittee?
Yeah.
Good work. Okay. Follow through on them. Why don't we take a break now, and then for 15 minutes, grab lunches, and we'll start at 12:45. Start up the meeting again.
Had ready for duty.
Next is transportation demand management, mobility programs update. Mr. Rabia.
All right, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I'm Chris Arabia, Manager of Mobility Programs with DRPT, and I'm going to give you a brief overview of transportation demand management. What is it? What does it do? How do we use it? And included in this update is an update on the new telework tax credit and also DRPT's Telework Virginia program. Transportation demand management, that's been around since we've had roads, since we had more than one transportation option. We just didn't call it that. It wasn't until probably the 1990s when that term, or also TDM, because it's really long to say, we have to abbreviate it, really started to be used. And that coincided when the rideshare agencies moved beyond just matching people into carpools, but also provided a lot of other services that meant transportation demand management. If you look up definitions of TDM, you'll find two things in common. One, TDM makes the transportation system more efficient, and two, it provides travel choices for people. And this is done by either reducing travel demand or redistributing that demand by changing the mode of travel, the time of travel, the route, or eliminating the trip altogether. Benefits of TDM. The benefits are that it optimizes the transportation system and also improves mobility, reduces traffic congestion, improves air quality. And the good thing about TDM, it can be used in all areas of the Commonwealth, urban areas, rural areas, in all different regions, regional programs, local programs, city programs. So it's very scalable to the needs of that community. So how is it done? As I said, part of the main thing in TDM is moving more people in fewer vehicles. And by that I mean carpools, van pools, buses, trains, removing the auto trip altogether by using telework or making it easier to bike or walk, or redistributing these trips through alternative work schedules at employment sites or even tolling. And the last bullet is sort of redundant, but I wanted to emphasize that getting people in transit is a major component of what the TDM agencies throughout the Commonwealth do. And a recent example of this, I'm just going to use the traffic TDM program out on Hampton Roads. They were very instrumental on working with citizens, with employers, when the Tide light rail system, even before that system was launched and when it was launched, to actually handhold people to show them how to use it and how they can get around using it. So that's just a small example of how the TDM agencies really go out of their way to get riders on our transit systems. So where can we apply TDM? Well, it can be applied to just about to solve or improve any transportation or non-transportation issue we might have. Mobility issues, congestion management, air quality or environmental issues. It can be used to help economic development, land use, even livability by helping to make a place a better place to live and work and play in. And these are just some of the TDM strategies, the most common TDM strategies that we use to be effective. But I want to emphasize the last bullet on this slide, employer outreach. This is a very important, in the 90s, that's when our efforts kind of shifted to the residential, from the residential outreach to employer outreach. And the reason for that is, one, you've got a nice concentration of commuters right there in the employment site, so if you can work with them to get to their commuters, it's a lot easier to reach them than in their homes. But also what we found is that when the employer really embraces TDM and really helps emphasize and encourage the use of transit and carpooling and vanpooling, that we see a 30 to 50% increase in the use of those modes when employers really push it at their employment site. So it's really important to work with employers and get them to buy into this and encourage their employees to use alternative commute modes too. I always put this slide in whenever I'm doing TDM, why market and promote TDM. It's something that we always kind of get questioned about. Why are we using these funds? Why are we using public dollars to do, you know, radio ads or newspaper ads? And the reason why is that, you know, when we look at TDM services, transit, vanpooling, carpooling, it isn't a build it and they will come type of situation that you may get when you build a new road. And the reason for that is people are, one, they don't want to give up that convenience of I'm in control if I'm in my car, if I'm stuck in traffic, hey, I can get out the next exit. Or also they have a concern, well, if I get on the wrong bus, where's that bus going to go? How will I get back to where I need to go? So there's some hesitancy for folks. So we really need to educate them on the system and how to use it. So that's the first thing we need to do is inform and educate folks. And that will lead to acceptance of these services, and not just by the people who use transit or who use these services, but acceptance by the people who don't use the services. We've done studies where it's shown that even people who do not use transit or carpool and vanpool, people who are in their car alone, they support TDM programs because they feel it's good for society, and also they feel, hey, if I can get that car, that guy in the car out in front of me, maybe I'll get to work a little quicker. So so when we do this promotion, even the folks who aren't using the services are generally accepting what we do. And then that acceptance leads to trial and then continued usage. And then ultimately it leads to advocacy, where you have organizations or groups of people or individuals supporting what we do. So what is DRPT doing? DRPT funds 16 TDM agencies through various grants annually. This money comes from the $4 million in Transportation Efficiency Improvement Fund. But we also get at least that and more through VDOT, through the Federal Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Funds for some of these TDM agencies. So we administer some of those grants for VDOT also. We provide them with our technical assistance on how they can improve their programs and get better at it. And we also do some promotion for them. If you might have heard Tri-Transit Week, that's a DRPT initiative to help folks get into transit and also other modes too. DRPT works on evaluation. We've done a statewide State of the Commute in 2007. We were planning on doing another one. That gives us a lot of great information on not only residents throughout the Commonwealth, their opinions or how they feel about transportation, but also why they use certain transportation modes and why they don't use certain transportation modes. And we use that information when we go out and develop our programs or to continue to refine our programs. We also do a placement rate study. We're going to do one in the next coming few months. What that placement rate study does is it looks at the rideshare databases of all the 16 programs that we have. We take a sampling of that and we find out, well, how many people, what percentage of people who are in that database are you placing into alternative transportation modes every year? So we get a lot of really good information about just the benefits of our program. And we're working on refining our performance measures. We have some measures for TDM programs, but TDM programs are different depending on what area they're serving. An urban area is a lot, TDM programs are a lot different than a rural area. And we can't give them the same type of measures. So we're actually going to be looking at doing a more comprehensive performance measurement system so that we can kind of compare apples to apples in rural areas to rural areas and not comparing rural areas to urban areas. About 2 years ago, we required all the TDM agencies getting funding through DRPT to do a long-range TDM plan. They've never had them before that. Every year they would come in for a grant, and that was about all the planning that we saw. So what we're trying to do is tie our programming of the funds to planning. And we also have them do now an annual work plan for when they come in for that grant. And the idea behind this is, one, to get TDM in the planning process and not just a little side project that folks can get a grant for, but also we want it to go in everyone's regional comprehensive transportation plans. And a lot of regions have already done that, and I think that's great because we see this as a transportation system. So if you're doing comprehensive plans, you should look at TDM in all the elements of your planning. We also are working on a big project where we're consolidating the ride matching systems for the Central, Southwest, and Southeast TDM programs. Those programs are on this old legacy system. It's more than 10 years old. It's a software system. It's just PC-based. It's not even internet-based. And 10 years in software is like a million years old. So we are definitely working to develop the list of criteria to kind of move them into one system, so that we'll have one database. And as commuters commute between regions, that's good because then they don't have to call two agencies. They can just call the one agency, and that database will serve the entire population. We also partner a lot with VDOT on a lot of TDM projects, in particular the mega projects, the Hot Lanes project for I-95 and 495 project, and also the Dulles Metrorail Extension project. There are transportation management plans associated with those projects that DRPT is partnering with VDOT to, one, develop the transportation management plan and also implement some of the TDM elements of the plan. And I'll explain one of those TDM elements further on in the presentation. This is just a map that's just to show you of the TDM programs that we have out there now and give you a general service area of of where they serve. And you can see some of these areas kind of overlap, and then we've got some holes we need to fill throughout the Commonwealth. So now I want to turn to telework. So you may have heard there's a new telework tax legislation that starting in tax year 2012, and it's going to provide up to $50,000 per business to spend on things that they need to spend on to get people, their employees, to telework. So things like computers and networking or internet capabilities, all of those things they can apply towards a tax credit. And it's up to $1,200 per new teleworking employee. And also there's up to $20,000 to do a telework tax assessment. So basically you can hire a consultant, they'll come in and they'll look at all your positions and see which ones are teleworkable, see which positions are not. They'll help you develop a policy, and that way you can implement telework. Because we understand a lot of businesses have informal teleworking where, you know, they let people work from home from time to time. And that actually can get businesses in trouble, because without a written policy, someone can challenge, why did you give this person that, you know, a telework day but not me? So with the policy, it actually helps businesses fend off any type of grievances about why this person can't. So there's backup to that policy that shows this position can telework and this position has duties, like it's a receptionist or something that has to be there and can't telework. So the total tax credit that's available, and this is administered by the Department of Taxation, not DRPT, is $1 million annually. And DRPT's role in this tax credit, well, last month we held a big webinar for businesses. We had over 100 businesses participate in that webinar. One, we try to get the word out about telework, the benefits of telework, and then we'll help businesses also work on their telework plans to see what answer any questions that they have. We also have a great website called telework.va.org, which has sample policies and a lot of Q&A things that folks and businesses might need. Also, some good training modules on not just for managers on how to manage workers that they can't see, but also for the teleworkers on how they could be a good teleworker so that their supervisor knows that they're working when they're home. So we have all that on our website. Now, we've had a Telework Virginia program since 2001, where we had a large sum of money to start that off. And originally that money was to fund up to $35,000 for financial incentives for business to start telework. Well, we have pretty much exhausted that funding since 2001. So we're kind of leaning on that tax credit for at least for the next 2 years and see where that might take us. We're combing through some of the businesses who are ending their programs, and if there's any leftover money from that $35,000, we're going to pick that up because through our webinar, we learned that the nonprofit businesses who don't have a tax liability in Virginia, obviously they can't take advantage of the tax credit. So we want to do some type of financial incentive to help them. So since the Telework Virginia program started in 2001, we've had 174 businesses either go through and complete the whole program, which takes about 1 to 2 years, or they're in the middle of the program right now. So that's a ton of businesses throughout the Commonwealth, and most of those in Northern Virginia where it started. But it started in Northern Virginia in 2001, and in 2006 we expanded to the Richmond region, and in 2007 we expanded to Hampton Roads. And that's why another good thing about the telework tax credit is that it's for any business anywhere in the Commonwealth, not just in those regions. So, and again, I mentioned the Telework VA website. It's a great resource if you want to learn more about telework or want to find out how you can implement a telework program at your employment site. So what are our DRPG's goals when it comes to TDM? Well, our main goal is something that we have to report annually through the Virginia Performance Measures, through Virginia Performs. And that is a reduction in vehicle miles traveled from our TDM program. So those 16 programs that we provide grant funding to, we use that placement rates survey that I mentioned earlier to find out how many people they're placing annually into alternative modes, and then how many vehicle miles that is reducing on our roads. And our goal is to reduce vehicle miles 2% annually. And that's going to fluctuate depending on a lot of factors we can't control, like gas prices. When it hits $4 and goes there, hey, we can do a whole lot. of reduction in vehicle miles traveled. But when it bounced back down under $3, we had the opposite swing. We had a lot of people get out of carpools and vanpools and into their cars. So in 2011, FY 2011, we estimated that 13 million miles of travel were saved by the TDM agencies. And that really is just a fraction of really the full benefits of those TDM agencies, but that's what we can measure right now. And that's why I mentioned that we're going to do some performance measure, a look at that, how we measure that, because right now all we can do is go into those databases, the rideshare database, and sample people, and then that's how we come up with those 13 million miles. But that doesn't include the telework program. It doesn't include all the other TDM things that these agencies are doing. And it's hard to get at that, because if you hear some messaging on take transit or get into a carpool or vanpool, you can do that on your own. You don't have to go to the rideshare agency and say, I want to get put in your database to be matched. So we don't know how many people we're really influencing. And so we're trying to get at that with some research and some surveying to figure out what is our potential, because we can estimate that just telework alone would probably double that 13 million miles. Just based on the telework Virginia participants, and we know that there's even more teleworking beyond that. So another goal of DRPT is to increase teleworking in the private sector. Our 2007 State of the Commute study showed that there are almost 800,000 workers in Virginia who say that their jobs could be done, part of the job could be done at home. So you've got almost 800,000 potential new teleworkers. We need to reach out to those businesses and help them telework. And, you know, you can imagine if we can do that, that might make some impact on our congested roads. There is also another telework goal, which is actually a goal for the state workforce. It's to get 20% of all state employees teleworking, or at least eligible positions teleworking. That's something that DRPT helps Department of Human Resources on. It's really their kind of goal. All the agencies report to the Secretaries of Administration and Technology, and they report on how each agency is doing on that. So, but DRPT has in the past worked with certain agencies on how they can evaluate positions to see if they're teleworkable, and we're always available to help out more of our state agencies on doing that. So in conclusion, I leave you with this statement about TDM, that it touches all aspects of transportation. It touches all users, no matter what mode they use. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary.
Ms. Drake.
Just two things I wanted to add to that, and that is on the tax credit that the Assembly passed this year, because it has a limit of $1 million for the 2 years, businesses must apply by October 31st of each year. So if they're going to want to use this tax credit next year, they have to apply by October 31st of this year. So that message we're trying to get out loud and clear so people don't get into next year and realize they can't do it. And also, even though we have used up the money that was available, the $35,000 Chris talked about in Hampton Roads, Richmond, and Northern Virginia, we still have money for mega project areas. So Northern Virginia still has money as well as tax credit up
and
there.
And just to elaborate, thank you for bringing up on the mega projects telework program. Through our partnership with VDOT on those mega projects, the Dulles Metro Rail Extension and the 495 Hot Lanes programs, we've developed a transportation management program that's funded to help businesses and commuters in the deal with the traffic and the construction. And part of that is a telework program that provides $50,000 for businesses in the construction area, not for all in Northern Virginia, but in Tyson's Corner. And then if you're really close to the Beltway on 495, you can take advantage of that. And that is available. But what we're doing is if you take the mega project $50,000, you can't take the tax credit. It's one or the other. And we're kind of working with you on which one might work best for you.
Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Lynn.
Secretary, along the lines you're talking about how we look at things differently, local TPO in Hampton Roads, if we would use these strategies, they have a report that says we could alleviate the congestion pretty much in the area if we were to use these strategies. So in addition to looking at things that we're doing administratively and how we allocate, this is something we ought to be advocating also, how we better use our limited resources.
Ms. Cooley.
Mr. Chairman, I want to
also talk about the effectiveness of this type of program in Northern Virginia. Increasingly, it's why, for example, Tyson's Corners asks for more density, because it gives the chance to do some of these things and not necessarily generate traffic. And the model that we're using, at least in our deliberations there, is actually comes from Arlington. Arlington's put these things together for some time, and I last time I looked at their budget, they had over $2 million for information, outreach, and education, because there's not a person in Arlington that they want to go without knowing where the bus is, how to get there, where it connects, what time it's going to come. So if you don't take it, it's just, or Metro, it's just because you don't want to. It's not because you don't have information about how it all fits together. So these things actually work. I also would like to say that the telework thing is always talked about in our area, not just for a private sector, but also for federal government employees. And we keep coming back not only to these tools that make it possible, but also the management changes that are necessary for an organization to really take advantage, one of which is bosses like to see their workforce in person. It's left over from, you weren't on the assembly line, I can't see you working, then you must not be working. So, but several companies in Northern Virginia have taken this to an extreme and have begun to reduce their commercial real estate footprint significantly, even up to 50%, and just by letting their workers work remotely from customer sites or from home or from telework centers, they're able to cut their commercial real estate bill in half. So that's a real incentive as these programs get more familiar and as new workers actually demand this option, that has a chance to grow. And I agree, the payoff is very large.
Very high.
We're getting into the numbers that would equate to a lane of traffic, basically. Mm-hmm. And anytime, and it's less expensive than building a lane. 95 or something. Like this morning. Could have had a lot of people telework this morning.
Well, that was because of a maintenance problem.
Yeah, that's right. It was. So thank you very much for the emphasis you're putting on it at DRPT, but also the collaboration you have with the mega projects. It's working very well, and it's been flexible and adjusting, and it's really into what works. So,
all right. Any other questions? Yes, Mark.
A comment, Mr. Chairman, and the disclaimer is no value judgment. Indeed, the only reason I'm associating it with TDM is because you made me think about it. But as we know, at this moment, resources, income is very important, and there seems to be a prevailing thought of tax structure ought to be more simple. And the point of all this is we seem to go to tax credits almost like a knee-jerk paradigm. And what I would encourage us is anything that we're associated with dealing with tax credit to make sure that we have verifiable that we can verify that it is going to actually be revenue positive within a reasonably finite amount of time.
Yes,
Rich. Does VDOT have a telecommute policy where our people can telecommute?
The Commonwealth does.
We do.
Are we hooked into that? Do we encourage it? Especially in Northern Virginia, congested areas, and Tidewater.
Although I'm going to say the majority of the people, obviously, that we have are actually boots on the ground.
I do know that some of the RVDOT colleagues in Northern Virginia do telework.
Yes, where it's possible. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Excellent. Thank you very much. Secondary street acceptance regs.
Good afternoon. Robert Harpercher with the Transportation Mobility Planning Division. Today we're going to talk about secondary street acceptance requirements and draft changes made to those as part of the Chapter 870 process. This last year, the General Assembly passed three bits of legislation that impacted land development regulations that VDOT has some touch with. And those were the traffic impact analysis regulations, the access management regulations, and secondary street acceptance requirements. Chapter 870 gave us an exemption from the Administrative Process Act to getting these done, but also set deadlines and when any kind of changes would have to be done. In other words, changes would have to be done by November 30th, and the revisions would become effective January 1st. The changes to the access management and the traffic impact analysis regulations would have to be approved by the commissioner, but the changes to the secondary street acceptance requirements require CTB approval. Now, what are the secondary street acceptance requirements? They are requirements that replace the 2005 subdivision street requirements, and they govern what kind of streets we can accept into the secondary system. In 2007, the General Assembly passed legislation that told the CTB to develop new regulations to make those regulations ensure the connectivity of road and pedestrian networks, minimize stormwater runoff, and to address performance of the streets. And these regulations were implemented in March of 2009. In order to implement those provisions, the regulations have certain elements in them. One, connectivity. The connectivity index, which is the number of street segments divided by the number of intersections, that's made to enhance connectivity. To control what target you have, we divide the state into area types, and require at least two connections for each addition. In addition, street system additions were grouped, so that instead of taking in individual streets, you took in networks, which gave you more flexibility as a developer. We also included pedestrian accommodation requirements, where previously, if you built it, we would take it in. Now, there was a requirement that you build it in certain cases. Under Chapter 870, to solicit public comments, we updated our website to solicit those. We also advertised to the Virginia Regulatory Town Hall. We contacted directly 300 individuals that had commented previously, and we had two public comment periods. Over 120 letters and emails were received regarding our regulatory focus. Regarding secondary street acceptance requirements, the several biggest comments had to do with the connectivity index. Most of them were, it's confusing, it doesn't increase efficiency, what does it do with connectivity, don't use it. They're also saying, hey, we need to find a better way to improve connectivity. We had comments about the pedestrian requirements were being too stringent. There was a request to eliminate or change the area types. There were also submissions saying, hey, keep things as they are. We haven't had enough time with them. We need to see exactly how they work out. And there were comments on providing a meaningful penalty for not connecting to a stub out, to an existing stub out. To review all these comments and suggestions, we formed two committees. There was an internal VDOT technical committee consisting of staff from the central office and from our district offices. In addition, we formed a policy advisory committee that was external to VDOT. That was headed up by Charlie Kilpatrick and consisted of folks from the regulated industries, other stakeholder groups, local governments, and organizations that had an interest in the process. Our proposal before you proposed to eliminate the connectivity index and eliminate area types, which drive the connectivity index, to reduce the median lot size where pedestrian accommodations are required, and to add a traffic volume threshold, because in certain cases, if the road carries so little traffic, it's not a problem having pedestrians walking adjacent to the road. In addition, to replace the connectivity index, to require additional connections for developments based upon either the number of dwelling units that the development has or the amount of traffic that it generates. We also wanted to move down waivers to as low a level in VDOT as we could get so that we could speed up the time for appeals and exceptions. In addition, this morning before the meeting started, a new copy of this regulation, the draft regulation, was handed out and dropped off on your desks. But between the time where the agenda was set and now, we found out that there was one document that we had deleted from the documents referenced in the regulation that we had to retain, so we added it back in. What steps come next? This afternoon, you will be voting on whether to accept these changes or not. And if you vote yes, the revisions become effective January 1st, 2012. Any questions?
Any questions? Yes, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think we've all gotten some questions about this. In fact, we all had questions still left from our previous consideration of this set of challenges, let's call it. But I want to focus in on two specifically. One, in page 23, the old strike out here, you don't have to look at it, I'll just read it. It talks about the old minimum was two connections. All network additions shall have a minimum of two connections. The new language, which is inserted, says network addition provides at least two external connections. So is there an inconsistency there? Somebody's trying to make one, but is two? Still two?
It's still two as a minimum, unless you meet certain exceptions.
Right.
But in addition to that, if your development is larger, or in terms of trip generation, it generates more trips, it require additional above those two.
Okay. So, in fact, what we're doing is applying the rationale behind the connectivity index without actually using the index. In other words,
the theory is there.
Connectivity,
correct.
As growth occurs.
It's a different way of applying it, one that some people view as being significantly more rational than the other.
Right. Okay. The second is, how does a district administrator designee waiver work? Would that be a complicated process or a simple, here's the five reasons why, and we study it and we look at it and then it's yay or nay?
We've tried to make it as simple as we can. You submit an email, or we have a form that you can use. It's basically a checkbox where this is the reason why we shouldn't have to do this. And then you submit the documentation that shows why. Goes to the VDOT person, they look at it. Yep, yes, you do have a railroad up there. You know, you do border Interstate 66. You can't connect. Fine. You don't have to do it.
Okay, because I know that from VDOT's perspective, you don't want more process.
Correct.
Necessarily. But from the private sector, they don't want more process either. So I just wondered how that would work. And the ways you've explained it is meant to be very matter-of-fact, straightforward.
Correct.
Kind of a request. The last question I have is, what is the rationale for change in changing the trips per day that would trigger the transportation analysis, a TIA? Is that just to avoid sort of too many marginal activities, or is it really because there's a significant difference between 2,500 vehicle trips and 5,000 vehicle trips?
In all honesty, the number of trips, the threshold, is basically the definition that the code allows us to make to say what constitutes a significant impact or a significant effect to the transportation system. The number of trips, we know that the number is greater than 1,000. We know the number is probably less than 10,000. What that number really is varies throughout the state. Because if you're on a roadway that's almost at capacity, adding 100 trips might be a problem. Whereas if you're on a road that's got plenty of spare capacity right now, you know what? Adding 1,000 trips a day maybe won't do a thing. So the process was to find some number that was reasonable. 5,000 ended up being with the committee. I'm not going to say there was consensus, but there was sort of at least an acquiescence in some parts that that was a good number.
So the point you're making is that the analysis at that level can be inexact.
Correct.
It's actually a small number that has to bear some relation to the overall capacity of the road as well as the additional impact.
Correct. But we chose just a straight number because it becomes difficult to implement. Mm-hmm. Because let's say you've got a development out in an area. Well, now, if we hinge it on the level of service of the roadway that you're fronting on, if we use that as a trigger, you would have to find out what is the level of service in front of my road, during peak hours, during average daily traffic. I mean, there's a lot more data that you'd have to generate just to know whether you're covered by the regulation or not. It's much easier to have one number that you have to generate, say, okay, I'm covered, or no, I'm not.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Morgan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate addressing two things. First being that how and why were the 300 people who had already commented chosen and invited to comment again. Second item being that y'all made very persuasive cases on these items that are now being eliminated and indeed quite eloquent in defending them. at the time. Succinctly and simply, why would the things we hear to change them today be more valid than the things we heard about adopting them in the first place?
Number one, dealing with how we determined who we contacted directly. What we did was we took the contact lists from people that had commented previously on the secondary street acceptance requirements, the traffic impact analysis, and other land use regulations that we've done. We took those contact lists and contacted those people again. Now, unfortunately, in the several years that it's been since they commented the first time, some addresses have changed, some people have moved, all that kind of stuff, so we didn't necessarily get to all of them. But we did send out to those same people that had commented on these previously.
So we tried to get all of them?
Correct.
Okay.
As for your other one, in terms of, you know, why are we changing now? It's only been in place a couple years, and that sort of stuff. Because the General Assembly told us to look at it and to consider public comment and to act on that comment. So, you know, when the bill passed, when Chapter 870 was enacted, we changed our site. We solicited comments from the public at large, from interest groups. We took what they said and said, okay, is there anything here that we should do, that we should act on? And we went ahead and acted on it. Does that mean the 2009 regulations were wrong? Far from it. It just means that there's different ways to skin the same cat. And one way, in terms of connectivity, is connectivity index. It's a tool that's been used in at least one locality in Virginia. It's used in other places across the country. But it's not the only tool. Delaware used a completely different tool. They use one based on distance of perimeter. There are just many ways to handle the same problem. And it turned out that in terms of applying these, that there were a lot of people that didn't like connectivity index. They said it limited them too much in certain ways, and it impacted internal connectivity in some cases more so than external connectivity.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Korsinski.
I just want to speak to that connectivity index. As somebody who's been a practitioner for the past 40 years, when we design a subdivision with our land planners and our engineers, it's much more an art, I think, than it is a science to a mathematical formula. And I was not for this when it passed the first time, and I encourage that this be adopted as reported now, because it does give more flexibility for creativity within the planning process than to have to follow the index. I'm just putting that out for my fellow CTB members to consider.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I've got several concerns about this. I'll outline them as briefly as I can. First, the timing on this. We're given something today and say we're going to have to pass it today. The first time we get this stuff was a couple days ago. This should have been what we need to do on these type of complicated things where there are a lot of stakeholders. I don't like to vote for things in a vacuum without hearing from my counties or the private sector or whatever. The month before, we ought to have the workshop on it, and then we can sit down and rationally deal with these types of things. I'm starting to get a lot of communications on this. I thought the white paper was not that helpful, frankly. The background paper was more attuned to about a fourth grade view of things. I think some of these things could have severe impacts that are not outlined. Getting rid of this connectivity thing, to me, just pushes a burden down the road on the taxpayer. We're talking about funding secondary roads and primary roads. Part of the purpose, as I understand it, for the connectivity is to ease the burden, make sure that things flow better and everything doesn't come out. You have all these cul-de-sacs and then everything comes out at once onto an ulterior or a secondary road. And therefore, then we have to come back to the Commonwealth Transportation Board and say, we've got a traffic problem. We need more money. But connectivity kind of helps alleviate that and allows fire engines to get into various communities without having to come down a cul-de-sac and come back and go all around. So I'm very concerned about that and the fiscal impact. The other matter is the Commonwealth and this board has been pushing greater communication between the transportation people and land use people. And another part of this reduces the traffic impact analysis threshold, the raises essentially. So we have less information, less traffic analysis. our Route 29 study, the bulk, the central portion of that said we've got to deal with curb cuts. Now, how are we going to know how this is going to affect these corridors of statewide significance? We don't have any traffic analysis. In my county, they told me, the professional people said, look, we're a rural county. They moved the threshold up. We'll never be able to qualify for any study. So we're operating in the dark. So I think this goes against what we've been trying to do. As I see it, too, it weakens the sidewalk requirement. And what's going to happen there is you get this stuff put in there. Again, the burden will be shifted later on to the Commonwealth because the citizens are going to say, I want a sidewalk. I don't want my kid run over. So we have to come back and allocate funds out of the six-year plan. So I think the way you've got this thing set up, number one, I don't like the way it's been tried to go through this process in a hurried fashion. I don't think that makes sense. Number two, I think this is going to have a bad impact on our secondary roads and so forth, and frankly, I'm concerned about it. And I think we need more information. From the information I have today, I'm not going to support this thing.
Other questions? Yes, Ms. Dallas.
One of the things I noticed on your bullet points, you mentioned about third-party inspections on the land use side. Now, does this mean we're eliminating all of our land use inspectors?
No, sir, it does not. What it means is we're giving the developers an option to use third-party inspectors in place of VDOT inspectors. That would help them out in terms of if they've got a faster process they need to get done quicker and the VDOT inspectors aren't available during that time period, they can use a third party to inspect it, and we'll take those documents and use those as part of the acceptance process.
Okay, so now this would also apply for any land use in that particular case, is that correct?
Just
entrances?
This only applies for subdivision streets.
Oh, okay. Okay, so those site plans or anything like that would be exempted from that third-party inspection.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Like another board member, I did not like this in the first place. I dislike it a little bit less now. I think that the whole set of regulations would help a great deal in the densely populated areas. I think it's a needless pain in the neck in the rural areas where getting people on to the main roads from subdivisions is not a problem. So I think the changes that are recommended are better. Or less bad, I should say.
Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Tyre, B transaction plan.
He's done pretty well.
Been here twice. It's the same one.
Yeah. Okay, but then I'm going to the same.
Yeah, you know the DBA
don't. No, maybe it's a little.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the board. Where we find ourselves with regard to V-Trans is in a transition period between the old legislation and the new legislation. The old legislation called for a V-Trans every 5 years, which meant an incoming governor may not actually get an opportunity to present a V-Trans plan, and that's where we find ourselves. We've received the previous administration's V-Trans plan in January of 2010. And I'll walk you through how we deal with closing the loop on the old legislation and implementing the new legislation. So what we did is we initially went to work on the multimodal strategic plan, which the governor presented at his transportation conference last year. And what the V-Trans action plan does is start to align agencies' missions and goals with the strategic plan and the action plan. And you've seen a couple of those already. You've seen VDOT's action plan, or their action plan. You've seen DRPT's action plan, and DMV's will be the next one coming before you, and eventually you will see all of those. So what do the action plans do? The action plans take the VTRANS plan, they take the governor's strategic plan, they integrate them, they create work plans or action or strategic plans for each of the agencies. And we put this thing in there called measures of success. That's a fancy way, or performance measures is a fancy way of saying we have limited resources and we need to accomplish only the most important things. So that's why we use the agency action plans to implement the strategic plan. And you can see, and you have received these from time to time, annual updates to the CTB. We send them to the governor and the General Assembly as a result of the legislation is required to get those, or instructs us to give those to them as well. So that's kind of where we are in terms of closing the loop on the last one. As I said, the action plan was the last piece of the previous VTRANS plan, but it actually fell to us because we took office after January of 2010. So we had to do both the action plan and the strategic plan. So where does that leave us? That leaves us moving forward with the new VTRANS update. There's a new timeline. In a perfect world, the governor, he or she, would prepare their VTRANS plan in the second year of their administration, their action plan for implementing it in the third year, and then they would have two legislative sessions at the end of their term to implement what was in their VTRANS plan. And that's essentially what that does. This creates a framework for us to accomplish that going forward at the same time as we close the loop on the previous legislation. So as I said, it took it from a five-year planning horizon to a four-year horizon, so every governor gets an opportunity. In 2009-2010, we issued the 2035 plan. In 2015, we'll issue the 2040 plan. So we were tasked with doing something in between. We could have called it the 2038 plan, or we could have called it something like that. We didn't want to do that. We're going to call it a 2035 update and transition it to a performance-based model. As I said, that's a fancy term for saying we have limited we have finite resources and an infinite need, so how can we focus our resources? And there you can see the goals, the performance measures, the process. We have a set of goals. We have target setting, resource allocation, close the loop with measuring and reporting the results, and then you start to cycle over again. Here are the goals that we'll be taking on the road later this fall. I won't read them to you because the important thing is that on the next page, after we get the stakeholder and the public input, we'll bring them back to you and tell you this is what the stakeholders and the public said about the existing goals. Do you want to keep the existing goals? Do you want to modify them? This is what the public said. So that'll be the next step for you. So that's all I have on VTRANS. If there aren't any questions, as I said, we find ourselves in this transition period.
I just have one quick question, Mr.
Stretch.
Does this plan or program or update, whatever this thing is called, does it take position on any particular project, or is it just the general goals that we're setting out, or any?
Yes and yes. It takes the projects and runs them through a set of criteria. How well they would associate us, essentially achieve these. When I was here before and gave you the results of the last performance measure, I walked you through how we did on all of these, and the one we did the worst on was economic vitality. And I had the opportunity to talk to some of you about how the project's going forward, and I will show you one in a few minutes that will address economic vitality as well. So yes, all the projects run through a matrix or a filter or a waterfall, as you call it. Shouldn't say all projects. The big projects, the ones that would be large enough to make themselves into the VTRANS plan would. So they're probably the largest 100 projects we have across all seven agencies. The smaller projects would not.
So it doesn't necessarily prioritize project funding. Is that correct?
It gives you information about when I walk you through the next presentation, I think you'll be able to look at the multimodal map and see that intuitively we get there.
Before you leave this, I know you haven't necessarily been to all of them. Ms. Busher, have your folks, just can you give us an update about the meetings, the fall meetings? Can somebody? Ms. Busher? Just so far about the meetings, you've had the fall meetings?
I think we've had a small but good group of citizens that have come to the first two meetings. We were in Bristol and Lynchburg. It's been a couple weeks. We had a more of a multimodal focus in terms of we had representatives from not only DRPT and VDOT, for which this meeting is a precursor to updating the six-year program, but we had aviation, ports, the multimodal office, DMV, and we each provided just a little bit of information for the audience in terms of what each of the agencies are responsible for. And I think we've had good comments from the citizens we have, but it was a little bit of a low turnout to begin with. We haven't done the fall meetings for several years, and we've just reinstituted them for all nine districts. So I'm encouraged that people are coming. There was a VML, I believe, or a VACO state meeting the two nights of the first two meetings, for which elected officials probably attended. So I would expect more attendance by some of the localities at the next meetings. We have one tomorrow night in Fredericksburg. And we have three next week, Hampton Roads, Northern Virginia, and Salem.
Mr. Chairman.
Excellent. Yes,
Mr. Chairman. I don't know the communications process that was used for this, but I do know when we were conducting the six-year hearings in each district in a previous life, when we always got great attendance in the Southwest. I was a little bit disappointed. I'm not so sure they had the connectivity, if you want to use it, because with multimodal and what was really going to be going on at the meeting was received very well by the public. I don't think they knew. And I don't know how, you know, that's a problem I think we've got to get the message out maybe in a different way or format or something and let the people know what we're actually doing there. I
appreciate your comment. We did advertise via the newspapers. We did a press release. We sent letters to elected officials from the localities and from the General Assembly. And the MPOs and the PDCs also, in many cases, will be participating at these meetings. But I'm hoping, as I know you are, that we'll have better attendance in the future. We will try to do more going forward, and perhaps next year when we want to repeat this going forward, so that it'll be understood that that's part of the calendar for the update of the six-year program. So hopefully that will help as well.
Okay, Busher, thank you.
Starr.
I'll just go back and address Mr. Rich's comment. In two areas of transportation, in both aviation and in rail and public transportation, we need to do an economic impact or a return on investment calculation, because the Port Authority is a quasi kind of business activity. We do that too. So that's three of the seven agencies. We do that pretty well. The others, we're just getting there. And as you look at these goals, when I was here before and gave you the report card, we failed in economic vitality. So what we've looked at since then, or what are the barriers to economic vitality, and what we've found is safety because of accidents and mobility, accessibility, and connectivity are barriers to economic vitality. So as this process unfolds in the future, you'll see a greater emphasis on economic vitality and alleviating those two barriers. Safety and security, and mobility and connectivity.
I noticed the connectivity is a big goal, just to going back to the last discussion.
So moving forward with the corridors, here's the law. It says we in the Office of Intermodal Planning are supposed to work with our stakeholders and make this happen. We're supposed to consider all modes. If we weren't considering all modes legislatively because of finite resources and infinite demand, we would have to figure out how we leverage our resources the best anyway. And what you end up with, presumably, is corridor master plans in certain areas. But as you look at the map, some of these areas have taken care of themselves. I-81, you heard a presentation today. I-95, there's a project going on the north. There's a project going on the south. You know about 460 from 295 to Suffolk. You know about 460 from Blacksburg to the Kentucky border. So you can start to look at these corridors and saying we're doing things. In the six-year plan, we addressed the issues at 29 and 460. A few weeks ago, you addressed the issues or some of the issues at 29 and 64. So some of these we've just dealt with. We may not have had a laid out process for dealing with them, but just because of the nature of what we do and the experience around the table, we've made the right set of decisions to deal with some of these issues. And what you see in the upper right hand corner of the map is a new corridor called Northern Virginia, and I will talk about that as we go forward. This is a corridor that will connect an economic engine, the Dulles Airport, to I-95. Ultimately, you can't really get to the Dulles Airport right now without going north to the Beltway and doubling back on the Dulles Access Road or the Dulles Toll Road, whichever you prefer to call it. And this will help us start to address other access points to our one of our major economic engines. In terms of the corridor that will be studied, you see it there. It picks up at the north end of the Tri-County Parkway and takes it north. What you need to understand about this area is three things. One, Northern Virginia, the metropolitan Washington area, has the worst congestion in the United States. That may be something you understand, or it makes sense or it doesn't make sense, but to me in the Office of Intermodal Planning, it doesn't really make sense since it doesn't have the largest it's not one of the largest employment centers in the United States, and it's not one of the largest populated areas. It's probably not in the top eight of either of those, but yet it still has the worst congestion in the United States. But you also know, in addition to having to go all the way into the Beltway and double back to get to the airport. When you received your freight study last fall, or maybe earlier this year, you know that that corridor from Tysons to Ashburn is one of the worst we have in terms of moving freight. There are a lot of reasons to move forward with continuing to study this project. So the process, the master planning process, would examine further segments for connectivity between 95 and the economic engine known as Dulles Airport. We'll take all the studies that we have underway and we'll kind of amass all of that data and figure out what is the next step forward. And that's what the resolution this afternoon will ask you to do, or it's already afternoon. That's what the resolution later today will ask you to do, is to take all of this data and instruct us to study that data and create the best master plan for this corridor and this economic engine.
Okay. Any questions, Mr. Tarr?
Yeah, I have a question on this, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
What exactly are we talking about north of the parkway? What area is that in the resolution? What exactly is that? This area has been kind of amorphous.
The Dulles Airport has a piece adjacent to it that has already started its way south. It has a piece from 95 that has started its way northwest. There's a piece north of 66 that is under study. There's another piece that's under study in or about in between 234 and Route 50. Mr. Garzinski, you know the geography there better than just about anybody else. As long as you keep nodding, I'll keep talking. And what we're doing is figuring out how we connect the dots. Because we have some dots on a map, we need to connect the dots. What we also know from a safety point of view is when you get that hourglass effect of four lane down into two, those all create safety issues, so we need to deal with both of those issues.
But this resolution talks about a specific area, right?
Yes.
North, let's see if I can get the exact language here.
Very cool. Let's see.
Examine improvements north of the northern terminus of the CTB preferred Tri-County Parkway. Where exactly is that on the map?
We have maps available.
Yeah. We got very little information on this.
Essentially, that north-south corridor takes the piece from 66 and studies it up to Route 50. And what we're saying is that probably isn't the right, that probably isn't long enough. Because what that does if it ends at Route 50 is it dumps some traffic that's otherwise going to Dulles, what we would call local traffic, onto 50 for some distance. We don't want to intermix that traffic that's going to Dulles with the regular traffic on 50. So we need to study a corridor that would move that traffic north of 57, the toll road, that way. That's what we're trying to study.
So it would go, you'd study it up to Route 7?
Potentially, yes.
What about beyond? Are you going to study a river crossing?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No, I'm not.
You want to?
So when you cross...
Do we need to make an amendment to the resolution?
So when you... you just.
I will defer to council if council is still in the room if I want to go across the river.
Well, you better talk to Marilyn first.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah,
I make a comment for Mr. Rich just to let him know that the governor of Maryland has been contacted about a river crossing, and Senator Warner has also come out about a river crossing.
All right.
Both supportive, and it's in dialogue.
Well, that's what I thought from the beginning.
I just wanted to make sure you knew that.
Remember back when we were talking about this, that's what I thought from the beginning. We were talking about a river to river thing, the old Outer Beltway. We're going to talk about back paths and this or that, you know, that type of thing. So we're looking at a river to river crossing, the same thing we did 20 years ago. I'm glad to know that. But right now we're still ending at Route 7, dumping all the traffic on Route 7, right? That's about as far as we go.
Yes, I won't say yes, but I'll say yes and because you create the opportunity to connect to 7.
Uh-huh.
You create the opportunity to connect to the Dulles Toll Road, and you create the opportunity to connect to 50, and you create the opportunity to connect to 234 business and ultimately 15. So you have more diversion points than you have today.
Well, I'm not so sure about it. I think I know where we're going now, and it's the same old thing. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Definition of insanity.
Keep doing it.
I just want to comment that the geography of the region is the geography of the region. That's all. And if it's something north of the end of the Tri-County Parkway, it's north of the Parkway. That's all. I don't think we should put artificial limits on what we're going to look at in terms of connecting deltas. I mean, that's the whole reason. So despite what the Deputy Secretary has said, I don't think anything's off the table. But I do think the body ought to make a good set of decisions, you know, once we get some sense of what we're attempting to accomplish here. But north is north. You know, Maryland's north. Pennsylvania's north. You know, the North Pole's north. I don't think you cut north off because at Route 7. Like you said, if you just dump traffic on Route 7, is that the best way to handle the situation that we're in? So, you know,
one question that I have, Mr. Chairman, where are we? There's some really tangible things that could be done. You know, we're already spending how much? What, $3.5 billion plus to get to Dulles. It already has its own road that you'd be arrested on if you're not going to Dulles. We also have the toll road. In my talking with people from Manassas and folks that don't know that I'm on the CTB, I always ask them, how do you get to Dulles? I said, no problem. There should be an improvement, let's say, at 28 and 66. But what are we doing on this 606 thing? That thing should have been four lane 10 years ago. There are concrete steps, affordable steps, that we could do. That would connect 50 to 28 and also right into Dulles. Especially, that's how you kind of get in with freight. Where are we on that? Why can't we just do some tangible things instead of having these grandiose things that will never happen?
It's the tire.
Oh, that is in that area that is highlighted on that sheet. That is inside of the study area.
Well, why don't we just do it?
I'm asking. Anything.
Because
where are we on that? Is that in a 6-year plan?
Well, yeah, I couldn't give you that update myself. I'm sure we could get it. But I think what you're talking about is exactly the problem we're trying to solve, which is to move north-south, you have to go east-west. And what drives traffic on 50 is exactly what you said. It's people trying to get to Dulles, even though 50 doesn't lead to Dulles. It's people on 66 trying to get to Dulles, and actually 66 doesn't connect to Dulles. So you go up, you go over, you go up, you go over, you go up, you go over. What we're trying to do is rationalize that and also assist the two counties that are most directly involved, three actually if you count Fairfax, deal with how to come up with a comprehensive solution that actually improves all modes of transportation in that corridor and lets the investments the state makes, the local governments make, and quite frankly the private sector make, come together and actually work together. So 606 is a part of it, 50 is a part of it, 234 is a part of it, 659 is a part of it. I mean, that's the problem. There's a lot of parts of it.
Is Selma part of it with the rail?
Oh, sure.
If we connect Manassas
We've spent all this money on rail.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I just don't want us to pre-engineer something that we don't understand what we need yet.
Are you looking into rail with this thing?
We're looking at all modes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Garson.
One other comment to reinforce what Doug is saying, that I think as David moves forward with this study, it's going to be imperative that we have a lot of interplay with Loudoun County,
yes,
Fairfax County, Prince William County, Stafford County, because the corridor really goes all the way. And that input is going to be important because there are lineup points. There's a Tri-County Parkway, there's a battlefield involved, there's a Bi-County Parkway, all within that boomerang that you see on the map there that has to be studied.
Correct.
And I think, you know, that's where we're trying to go. We're not trying to automatically build a bridge across the river.
Right. Well, I think it's so important that we talk to these localities. You know, Loudoun voted 6-1 against this thing. As they say, it won't work. It's going to ruin around 7, around 50. So we need to talk to these people. I think we need to get them involved. We probably need some rail down 66.
That's what the whole process is, isn't it?
Okay, any more questions?
I just have one. to Commissioner Coulomb's point, we'll study whatever you want us to study. Do you want us to stop at 7 or do you want us to go farther north?
You know, we're not. When I originally introduced the resolution to establish the corridor, my whole goal was river to river, because the geography doesn't stop just because Route 1 is there or 7 is there or 50 is here, and that's been part of our problem. We have great connectivity needs with Maryland, and over time the Woodrow Wilson Bridge is great, but it's not going to be able to service in that part of the Potomac. I mean, people are talking about ferry service, expanding the 301 bridge, another crossing there potentially. I mean, it's not just about a Techway bridge in this part of the river. But
well, I think Mr. Rich was actually arguing in favor of going north of 7.
No, I was not.
Did you say you want to walk up?
If you're going to do something, which you don't have the power to do.
Dallas and LaGuardia.
But you were concerned about dumping all those people on Route 7.
Absolutely.
Well, if you kept going, you're right.
If you think you can get a river crossing, the governor of Maryland or the Commonwealth or whatever they call themselves, I don't know if they're a Commonwealth.
State of Maryland.
and you come up with the $4 billion or whatever it is, you know, that's something else. But there are certain things we can do now, is what I've been trying to say. I get on that 606 thing trying to get to the airport, and it's back clear up to Route 50. It's just airplanes. So there's things we can do now, instead of these long studies. And another thing I'm concerned about, having sat on the 29 corridor thing, all of the recommendations were ignored. None of the technical recommendations were followed at all, including the recommendation from Parsons. So you can study, and then ignore, go through all this money, and then ignore the experts, and you're going to be nowhere. We're going to be, you know, treading in place.
Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, one other question.
Mr. Krasinski.
David, do you have a timeline for this? Because I think it's important that we know kind of where this is heading in terms of the deliverable back to us. On the studies, I mean, do you have a written time range? Or is it just in this 3 years?
I kind of anticipated this was going, so I've already started working on the task order with the consultant, and I would suspect we would get back to you pretty quickly within a few months of where we are in terms of all of the status of where all of the different things are that are underway, and then probably give you some 6-month benchmarks and probably 6, 12, and 18 months report back to the CTB.
Okay, thank you, David.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. That finishes off our workshop agenda. At this point, we're going to close out the workshop and gavel in the action agenda for the Commonwealth Transportation